Welcome to the second day of the council meeting. To steal a line from a Seinfeld episode, it's go time, Butterbean. Today is the longest day of the year, and I'm hoping it's not going to be the longest day of the year for the council. I think today is it. This morning, all the usual housekeeping items, cell phones please on vibrate. We will try and take breaks approximately every 90 minutes, depending on how things are running on the schedule. As I indicated yesterday on today's item, Herring, I am going to take the comments. Essentially, if those of you who are looking at the decision document, document number five, there's a, I guess it's a graph on page one, which shows the four different groupings of alternatives that will be acted on today. We're going to take them in the order of catch monitoring at sea will be first, FMP adjustment second, river herring bycatch third, and midwater trawl access fourth. That's pink, blue, green, purple. If your printer worked better than mine, because mine printed them in different colors. So on each of those groupings, I will take the public comment up front, and then the debate will move to the council, and we will finish with that section and then go on to the next one. With that, if there are questions, Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify for the day, instead of having to repeat myself on all of those sections, I just wanted to inform you as the chairman and the council that I will be recusing myself on all decisions, in that there certainly appears that the company that I work for, that we exceed a certain level of interest in the herring fishery. So instead of repeating myself on each motion as we move through the day, I just offer that at the beginning, and I certainly hope that you will allow me to state my preference perhaps on the motions, but I will not be voting.
I will allow you to state your preference and to say to you that that's your choice of, you know, what comments that you want to make. With that, I will turn it over to the chair of the Herring Committee, Doug Grout.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're here today to make selections on final management measures for Amendment 5. As you see in our document, we have a variety of information to work from here. I think probably the most important document would be the decision document, which is item 5 that you should have up, probably the public hearing document. And you also, committee members might want to have, Lori had sent motions that the Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council made on Amendment 14. She sent that via email to you folks. If you happen to have that, you might want to have it with you. The rest of the information is all supporting information, including the Advisory Committee report and the Enforcement Committee report, as well as the FMAT report. Before each section, Lori's going to put up a section of the decision document to go over briefly some of the decisions that we're going to be going through. And at that point, once she's through with that and we've taken any questions on it, we'll then turn it over to Rip for public comment before we get into any motions here. So, Lori, would you like to start off?
Sure, thank you. I'm just going to run through a couple of the tables in the decision document. We're going to take this one step at a time. The first As Rip mentioned, the first section that we're going to tackle this morning will be the pink section, which is the catch monitoring at C section. There are several elements of this section. The first and most significant element that I think we're going to be dealing with this morning are the alternatives to allocate observer coverage on limited access herring vessels. The decisions regarding the allocation of observer coverage and the vessels to which this may apply sort of shape the rest of the decisions that need to be made about the FMP adjustments and some of the elements of the blue section. So we're going to go ahead and tackle the big one first. There are two committee motions dealing with the alternatives to allocate observer coverage, and in the decision document there are three decision tables that summarize the issues related to these alternatives and to these two motions. So I'm just going to go through the first three tables in the decision document, starting on page 3. Right below the Herring Committee motions, which we'll come back to in a minute, there's a table that summarizes the four alternatives under consideration for allocating observer coverage in the fishery. Essentially, what we need to do today are make several decisions. First, we need to select the alternative for coverage levels for the limited access herring vessels and select the permit categories to which this would apply. Consideration of potential consideration of a sunset or a review of the observer coverage levels. We need to decide how coverage will be funded, and I'll get to a second table about that. We need to consider an option for authorizing states as service providers and consider any waivers that may be granted in any circumstances where an observer is not provided. Of the four alternatives under consideration, they range from no action to 100% coverage and a couple in between. The Herring Committee passed a motion recommending alternative 2, which is 100% coverage on A, B, and C vessels. That's all limited access herring vessels. The advisors brought forward no specific recommendation on observer coverage levels. The Herring PDT and the Mid-Atlantic Council's Mackerel FMAT met and reviewed the alternatives and didn't really provide any recommendations on a specific alternative, but provided a lot of information about some of the issues that need to be considered when developing an industry-funded monitoring program and how there's some advice in the PDT report about how to shape goals and objectives for a monitoring program that may be able to streamline costs or increase the efficiency of the monitoring program. So I would point you towards the May 22nd PDT report for more information. That's in your binder as well. NIMS regional office comments are in their letter, important to consider. NIMS in the letter stated that the agency cannot support alternatives that require high levels of coverage because the increased coverage is not affordable for the federal government. And the letter strongly encouraged or urged that the council develop a mechanism for funding any additional coverage levels that the amendment may require. Enforcement committee suggested that requirements for 100% coverage and what that exactly means need to be clearly defined. And then as I presented at the last council meeting, the public comments on this issue were largely supportive of 100% observer coverage on A and B vessels. The industry is generally supportive as well, with some caveats on the funding. The industry did come forward and support 100% coverage with a contribution of $325 a day. And at the bottom of this table, there's some other important considerations for you just to take a look at. There's a few references to some sections of the amendment if you want to look at the analysis. And then the Mid-Atlantic Council, in their mackerel amendment last week, did pass a motion that would recommend 100% coverage on midwater trawl mackerel vessels. And then for their bottom trawl mackerel vessels, they did a tiered breakdown or a sort of a progression of observer coverage based on the tiers in the fishery. Going on to the second table, I'm just going to cover the first three tables right now before we turn it over to comments or further discussion because they're all related. The second table just lays out some of the details regarding the funding options. The first table gave you a whole list of questions to consider and decisions that need to be made, but then you kind of get into the funding options, and there are more details even there to consider. How are the details of the industry-funded program going to be developed and implemented? How will the costs be shared or distributed initially? How will this change over time? And then what is the intent with respect to observer coverage for the Amendment 5 vessels during the transition period from now until Amendment 5 is implemented and some industry-funded program comes online, if that's where we are headed? So there's a lot of comments about this in the May 22nd PDT report. I think everybody needs to recognize that if we're going to move forward with an industry-funded monitoring program in this amendment, a lot of the decisions can be made today so that we can begin the work on finalizing the amendment, but there are still a lot of details to be worked out, obviously, bringing in service providers and things like that and setting standards for service providers to sample this fishery isn't going to happen overnight. So when making the decisions today, I think we do need to recognize that as much as we want to have Amendment 5 implemented on January 1st, there may be some elements of this amendment that are going to take a little bit longer to implement or take a little while longer to come online. So it may be worthwhile for the council to talk about that interim or transition period, especially if this amendment includes a requirement for a high level of observer funding, observer coverage that cannot be funded by the federal government. There needs to be some discussion of what's going to happen until that industry funding comes online. So that's kind of the gist of this table. Once the decision is made about how much coverage we want in the fishery. As I mentioned, the committee does support funding option 2 with a maximum contribution of $325 per sea day by the fishing industry. That was also the motion that passed at the advisors meeting. A lot of the public comments from the industry supported that as well. The Mid-Atlantic Council at the bottom of this table, you'll see the Mid-Atlantic Council did pass a motion. There's no motion from the Herring Committee on this issue. The Mid-Atlantic Council's motion included a $325 per day contribution of any vessel participating in the mackerel fishery to fund the goals that they specified in the mackerel amendment. Moving on to the last table in this section, these are the options for service providers and waivers. Decisions related to this, if there is an industry-funded monitoring program adopted, do we want to upfront authorize the states to be service providers? This was sort of a carryover when we had portside sampling in the amendment because a lot of the states are involved with portside sampling, so we wanted to sort of grandfather them in as service providers for the portside sampling program. We no longer have portside sampling in the amendment, but we do have sea sampling. So the question now is, do we still want to grandfather the states in as service providers for sea sampling? And if we do, should some set of streamlined requirements be developed? That can be something that the staff can work with the regional office and the Science Center staff to do following this meeting if the council wants to do that. And then if we go with an industry-funded monitoring program and we utilize service providers, there needs to be some determination made of what will happen in the event that an observer cannot be provided for a specific trip. So there needs to be consideration of whether or not there will be instances where waivers should or should not be granted in the event that an observer cannot be provided. So that's it. That's generally the observer allocation alternatives and the issues related to funding the monitoring program. There are other elements of the pink section, but these three tables on pages 3, 4, and 5 address the first two committee motions. So I think I'll stop there.
Okay, we will open up the public comment session on this section. I'm going to first take any comments from our elected officials. I believe there's somebody from Representative Peek's office. If somebody else, please let me know.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. My name is Jocelyn Carey. I'm legislative aide to Massachusetts State Representative Sarah Peek. Representative Peek is also the Massachusetts Legislative Commissioner to the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. I'm here on her behalf to testify in favor of the provisions outlined in a letter that should be in your packet of public comments that was sent from a bipartisan group of Massachusetts legislators. Not only was the letter signed by members across the aisle, but it also has the support from members across the Commonwealth. These legislators overwhelmingly support provisions for 100% observer coverage on Category A and B herring vessels, and they support closed Area 1 rules, which have proven to be effective. They also urge the Council to support measures that will discourage the practice of dumping, require accurate weighing and reporting of catch across the fishery, creating a river herring catch cap, and finally prohibiting midwater trawl vessels from fishing in ground fish closed areas. These measures will help ensure the viability and stability of the herring stock and all other species that rely on a robust herring fishery, as well as ensuring the stability of the New England commercial fishing industry. Thank you very much for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you. Is there anybody else that I'm not aware of from an elected official's office? Seeing none. Two comments before I open it up to the public. You'll notice that there's a sheet up there asking to, for the record, to please state your name, the organization you represent, if you happen to represent one, and the number of members belonging to that organization. If you happen to speak several times today, you only have to do that once for us. And let me caution people that I expect all of the comments being made to be made through the chair, not directed at any of the other council members. So anybody who would like to comment on this first section? I see Ellen, and then I see Steve next, and I think Gary's got his hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ellen Gaethel, Fishing Vessel, Ellen Diane. I just have a really quick comment on the recommendation by the committee for alternative two, 100% coverage on category A, B, and C. Sea vessels, I don't think, should be added to this. C and D vessels, the one A, B category boat catches more than the entire C&D fleet in a year, and $325 a day for 100% coverage would put this fleet out of business. So I would ask that you would separate the A and B vessels from the C&D vessels throughout the document. Thank you.
Steve.
Good morning. Thank you, Rep. My intention was only to comment on the motions from the hearing committee, but I'd like to just preface that by saying that I represent, I am the chairman of the Choir Coalition, which had, as you all know, has recently submitted a sign-on letter that has 650 businesses and organizations listed on that letter. Those are real people. Those are real fishermen, those are real people who depend on the Gulf of Maine and Georges Bank for their living. Real people. Those 650 businesses, we didn't count them up. We were going to do it at one point, but they represent thousands of people. I'm also a director of the Atlantic Bluefin Tuna Association, which has in excess of 300 members, which also support me and what I'm going to say today. The Choir Coalition has been involved at this, in this process from the get-go. It's been 5 years. We've all spent a lot of time, and I'm very hopeful and have, I have great hopes that today is going to be a successful meeting, and it's going to be, have been worth the effort. You all have our letter. I'm not going to repeat everything that we've said in that letter, but I would like to talk about the motions. I went to the hearing committee meeting. It was a good meeting. It was a lot better meeting than I thought it was going to be. It was very effective. I thought Doug did a great job, and I'm hopeful this meeting will be the same. But in the first motion, I just want to comment that we support 100% observer coverage, but for A and B vessels only. It's important, I think, that it's A and B vessels only. They catch most of the fish, and I think to spend money, it's not worth the money to monitor the sea vessels. And if you look at their directed herring trips, I don't think there's many of them anyways. I am also concerned that the National Marine Fisheries Service has tried to throw a wet blanket on this whole process, and it really discourages me not only for this herring process, but just for their conduct in general. It's not for us to worry about their budget. It's not for you guys to worry about their budget. If you think 100% monitoring is necessary, if you think it needs to be shared between the fishing fleet and the government, which, as far as I'm concerned, the government should pay the whole darn thing. But if it has to be shared, the government has to share it, and they have to pay it. It's not for us to worry about their budget. I would love to be part of their budget committee and help them find the money to do this, because it's there. There's plenty of money there. There's a lot of waste in that agency. It's not for this group to worry about it. As far as the states acting as a service provider, I'm all for that, as long as they're held to the same standard that all the other service providers are held to. Second motion that day, I think, I don't know if I'm doing this right, Doug, but the second motion that day was discussing a waiver. As a fisherman, I think it is unfair to not be able to go fishing if there can't be an observer provided. So I'd be hard-pressed not to agree that there ought to be some option for a waiver. But that waiver can't be a catch-all for lack of funding for monitoring. And I don't think that was the intention of the committee that day. I've talked to some people. If it's a rare occurrence, I'm for a waiver. It's an unfair to tell a fisherman he has stayed tied to the dock. But if 60, 70, or 80% of the trips, when it's supposed to be 100%, are going to be waived, that's not right. So I hope this group will at least discuss the language of that waiver to make sure that this isn't a catch-all for lack of funding. You know, I guess what I just have to, as far as the motion, I think it was motion 4, as far as the dumping, anti-dumping, the ten dumping events leading to trip termination. The only thing I want to say there is that there's been basically a pilot project in closed area 1 where there's been stricter monitoring rules. It's been very effective for 2 years. Closed Area 1 rules are the Closed Area 1 rules. I hear, and I get confused when I go to these meetings, I hear staff say, well, it's really not the Closed Area 1 rules. The Closed Area 1 rules are the Closed Area 1 rules. Whatever's going on out there now is, when we talk about applying that to other areas, that's what we are talking about. That means if you dump any kind of dumping, you leave the area. Everything comes aboard, if it can come aboard. There can be no misunderstanding on that. It either is the Closed Area 1 rules or it isn't the Closed Area 1 rules. And I just want to close by saying that, you know, I've been doing fisheries management stuff for 40 years, mostly related around bluefin tuna, but it was quite an education doing that. I have never seen so much agreement in something on the coast of New England, specifically Maine and Massachusetts, as I do on this issue. These guys have the privilege of towing this gear in this area. They ought to prove that they're as clean as they say they are. That's all we're asking for you to do, is to monitor this fleet. Let's see what they're doing, and let's learn from it. And thank you.
Thank you. Gary?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Gary Libby. I'm a ground fisherman from Port Clyde, also the vice president of the Maine Fishermen's Association, but I don't necessarily speak for all the membership there. First off, I want to address what the first two speakers address about the alternative two from the Herring Committee, where they put the 100% coverage for the A, B, and C vessels. I don't believe C or D should be involved with that because of the percentage of the catch that they have in not many directed herring trips, and it's not cost effective to try to monitor every single one of those trips. If we get the A and B vessels, then we're going to get 97% to 98% of the catch, and I think that would probably be enough. Next item was the funding options. Well, I believe that a maximum cap of $325 a day paid by industry is fair. I think it's going to be shared. I don't think the government's going to keep footing the bill for all funding in all fisheries. I think you're going to see this going down the line in other fisheries, not just the herring fishery. So I believe the $325 should be a maximum, so there is some sort of cap on what people have to pay for observer coverage. Maybe we could get it streamlined, and the $325 would be enough. Then possibly $325 would be the maximum, so you wouldn't be locked into $325 necessarily if you could streamline the costs. And as far as the waivers go, I agree with Steve. I don't think anyone should stay tied to the dock because an observer can't be provided, but there's got to be a high coverage of those observers on those boats. It can't be an excuse. If you can get it up to 75%, 25% waivers and 75% people there, that's probably acceptable. My thought is to try to get 100% on there. And we move on to, I'm trying to be brief here, move on to the maximize sampling. Well, in that part of this, I think these last two sections that Laurie really didn't discuss are kind of linked together. Maximize sampling is something that needs to happen. They need to count the fish. All the public hearing comments came out, and they requested that we know what's being caught, and I think it's a good opportunity for the industry to prove that, because I think most of the guys out there are really working to not catch bycatch. But a full retention part of this could be solved by EMS cameras on boats to, if they was to bring the fish in and it could be sampled at the dock, then the EMS could show what was being discarded and what couldn't be pumped. I realize the dogfish are a big problem. They're a pain in the butt. I deal with them myself, ground fishing. But I do think that we need to monitor the boats, make sure the retention's covered, make sure guys can go out and get fish because they have a limited amount of days to do that. And the 100% of the A and B thing is, A, B, and C thing is my main point in this whole part of this this section of this amendment. I don't think C vessels should be subject to this 100% coverage because it's an incidental catch for them. If they are targeting, that might be a different story, but I don't believe most of the time it's incidental. They're whiting fishing boats, or they're a squid boat, and they happen to encounter those things. It becomes an incidental catch. It's not really a targeted catch. So C would lower the cost, and we got to figure out how to lower the cost in all fisheries for observer coverage. But we need it. So thank you.
Thank you. Jeff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the council, I'm Jeff Kalin. I work with Lund's Fisheries Incorporated in Cape May, New Jersey, and I'm very happy to be working for the family-owned company. We're active in the pelagic fisheries as well as a number of other fisheries, and most of you know that I've been coming to council meetings on Atlantic herring since 1986 when I was the director of the Maine Sardine Council. And over the years, I think the industry has worked well with the council. We were the first fishery to support a hard cap on the fishery. We've had mandatory reporting in place for a number of years. We were one of the first fleets, I think, in New England to go to VMS. And I'm pleased today that this long process of innuendo and accusation and class warfare, as we noticed in the Portland paper yesterday, may actually be coming to an end. I'll try to keep my comments to this portion of the discussion and refer to the letter that I wrote for our company. I think we also had 50 or 60 individual people in the company sign letters on this amendment. We've been trying to do that because we're up against, you know, 80,000 letters from people from Timbuktu and Brussels and so forth, and we've been trying to illustrate to you that these decisions affect not only those of us who own the boats, but many other people who work in our distribution center, our factory, and so forth. And we employ probably 150 people during the course of the year in Cape May, New Jersey, some of the only year-round jobs available down there outside of the Coast Guard Training Center. I want to thank the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission and ACCSP for their long support for our shoreside monitoring program that Massachusetts and Maine have been working to bring good information about our bycatch to the table, and I think we're a clean fishery. I think the data supports that. I also wanted to thank Dan and the agency for its letter, both to this council and the other council, because I think you begin to shed some light on what is possible here to accomplish, given the very scarce resources that the agency has and we have as vessel operators and owners. We're not making a lot of money in the herring fishery. The scallop fishery is keeping everybody afloat, and we do have scallop permits, fortunately. So I wanted to thank the agency for their letter. Initially, when this process started, I advocated that the SBRM process should dictate what our coverage and our fleet should be, because SBRM was focused on observer coverage that would provide good assessment-related data to the Science Center. And I don't think our bycatch, whether it's river herring or haddock, are affecting the mortality rates of those species such that there's a problem from an assessment perspective. And I think we're getting lost about this observer coverage issue. Everybody wants 100% observers on everybody but them, because, you know, they don't want to pay for it. Well, I think the C boats should be part of the solution here, frankly. I think the D boats should be part of the solution here as well. We have no problem with that. We run D boats too. And everybody who's, there's a bycatch of river herring, they ought to all, that's later in the agenda, I'm sorry I got off track, they ought to all be part of the solution. So we started out with SBRM, and then we took a position that we will take 100% observers on the bigger boats for a limited period of time. I think it's important that it be reviewed after a couple of years. The cap, I support the committee's motion that caps the cost at $325 a day. We've heard from the observer program that a new program that with industry funding should probably take place over a couple of years. The program should be developed by the observer program before the industry funding comes in, so that you know what you're buying. Are we going to have monitors? If we have monitors, we lose assessment-related information. So I hope there's a process where we can work with the observer program and the council to institute a cost-effective monitoring program in this fishery. The agency's letter says that, you know, they acknowledge the potential for substantial financial burden and that those costs need to be weighed against the benefit. We're supporting 100% observer coverage today at $300 a day, $325 a day, but I think long-term we're better off funding shoreside monitoring and the bycatch avoidance project. We're already beginning to fund the SMAS project in the scallop industry, so a couple of years from now, I think hopefully we're making decisions about a better mix of monitoring in our fishery other than the 100% observer coverage, but we are supporting that for a couple of years. The waiver is important, not so we can get away with anything, but so that we're not tied up if we can't get an observer to the boat. I'm glad to see that some of the conservation community is supporting that approach, too, and we're supporting the waivers. As far as maximizing the sampling at sea, we don't have any problem with giving visual access to the net and the cod end. We've said before it's difficult to bring that rig over the side. We're not set up with tackles overhead and so forth to do that. But our captains tell us that their relationship with the observer program is good, and that we're not having any difficulty having them see what our catches are. On net slippage, we don't think a lot of that is going on either. I don't like the 10, you know, slipped events and you're out approach. I don't know how that's going to be enforced, frankly. So the affidavit, the slip catch affidavit, we thought was valuable. Apparently that's losing favor with the agency now, where the captain signs under penalty of perjury and explains why the reason that some fish weren't brought aboard. I don't know why that doesn't work. But the three exemptions for safety, mechanical failure, and spiny dogfish need to be remembered as well. And as far as maximized retention goes, again, that's probably a good option for us a couple of years down the road. Bring it all on shore, look at it on the beach, you know, put our money on the beach and look at our catches. We don't go to sea to dump fish. We go to sea to catch fish and make money, and we have very high fuel costs. We're not out there screwing around. We're not dumping fish. There's very little discards in our fishery. In fact, it's negligible when you set the specs. So I think we're doing a good job. We intend to continue to try to fish responsibly, and we look forward to the resolution of this amendment today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Council. My name is Pam Lyons-Grom, and I'm the Executive Director of the National Coalition for Marine Conservation. We are a part of the Herring Alliance, along with 51 other organizations, and together we represent about 2 million different people. I'd like to speak today in support of the 100% observer coverage, but to A and B only. Not only do the A and B vessels take most of the catch, they certainly profit the most from the catch. And you have to think about the C vessels and what the cost of an observer is going to be in comparison to their daily operating costs. So we do not support that. And even though today we're kind of separating out this public comment into different sections, I think it's really important to recognize right from the start that this is all part of a bigger strategy. And we support 100% observer coverage in large part because we support a river herring cap immediately. And because these events are rare but can be very large when they occur, so large that they could actually be equivalent to an entire state's river herring run in a specific river, we believe we need 100% monitoring to capture those events and to accurately account for that bycatch. It's also really important that we sample and look at all the catch. So we support closed area one provisions, and we support limits on dumping, which you can find the details of that in our letter. Finally, I want to comment also, I appreciate that under the important considerations in your decision-making document today, that the Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council motions are included. But I think it's very important to consider how your actions today and your decisions on things like catch monitoring impact what the Mid-Atlantic Council chose to do in their strategy to address river herring and shad bycatch monitoring, and also the cap that they chose to do last week. So please keep that in mind. I actually think it's important to look at this holistically, even though I understand why we're kind of breaking it out today. Please take those considerations in mind as you progress throughout the day. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Patrick Paquette. I appreciate the opportunity to address the council. I'm not going to read my resume, but when it comes to the Atlantic Herring Fleet, I regularly report to 34 recreational fishing organizations. I feel like I'm going to Timbuktu when I drive to the Connecticut Surfcasters. And about 8 weeks ago, we had the latest meeting of that organization, and the bulk of that conversation was questions about this, about the Atlantic Herring Fleet working in and around Rhode Island state waters. I absolutely felt like I was going to Brussels when I went out to the Pioneer Valley Boat and Surf Club and had 400 people to the point that we were out in the parking lot talking about the effects of midwater trawlers on the waters in southern New England. We weren't speaking specifically of the other species we'll get to when we get to that section. We were just talking about the general effect of what happens when these fleets come into inshore waters. And being a resident and a charter boat owner on the backside of the Cape, in August, when the fleet comes and works the corners of Area 1B and Area 2, when they're done, we're done fishing. We then have to go fish off Nantucket because our bass move because there's no bait left. I got into this subject of trying to bring reforms to this fishery over 10 years ago because of seeing the effects of the fishery on my water and in front of what it was. And I believe that this fishery needs intense monitoring. I believe that the mere scale of this fishery is what has brought the recreational fishing community to the table and has had us remain here through the development of Amendment 1, through Amendment 4, has had us in court over Amendment 4, and has had us vigilant through Amendment 5. I can't give you the actual number, Mr. Chairman. I know you're requesting it, but I'm pretty sure that when you add in the fact that I'm an RFA advocate, it's well over 250,000 recreational anglers that have been weighing in and commenting on it, and it's well over 1,000 businesses. That being said, 100% monitoring when we have commented as a community meant 100% monitoring. We believe that the scale of this gear requires that mistakes, not intentional, not bad, that mistakes of the scale that can happen in this fishery must be witnessed by a federal observer. When the boat leaves the dock, there needs to be an observer on the boat. I do want to acknowledge that we're very unhappy with the services letter. However, I think that it's important that this whole debate about whether the council can require 100%, I absolutely agree with the services letter that the council can't require anything of the secretary, but you can recommend that the secretary require, and I hope that the language is clear and that your intent is clear when it leaves this table, whatever that may be. Let's make sure that there is no more loopholes in this fishery, because that has been one of the problems that has kept people coming back to this table when it comes to catch monitoring. So obviously my community is against the waiver. That being self-reporting in this fishery must end. Whether that's regarding dumping or actual landing of catch, self-reporting of this scale is just beyond common sense. You have before you plenty of options to correct that and to make sure that both the overall catch and bycatch is witnessed. The closed area one rules work. The ones that are on the water, the ones that went through the second round after the negotiated legal activity, those are working. They have discouraged dumping, and dumping is significantly down. Why would we not want to make that fleet-wide? That would seem to be a common-sense, easy-to-get-behind alternative, is the current version of closed area one rules on the water. No loopholes driven through the middle of them. And finally, I want to remind the council of two pieces of testimony that have happened over the many years in hard work, and that would be that the industry has admitted that it fishes on or close to the bottom. The industry has admitted that they, and I'm going to quote Jim Rule, it is common to go back out to sea and dump unmarketable catch. The fact that that practice is allowed is criminal with the strain on today's marine resources. It is. And it is what drives recreational fishermen through the roof to see wasted resources like that. These are the kind of common sense things that we want to see through these catch monitoring alternatives. And we hope that you give that complete and total consideration as you go through what's going to be a very difficult day. And I just want to take one opportunity, and I'm really not trying to pander, but I hope that the hard work of all the staff of the council is appreciated by the end of this meeting, because it's been a long road and there's been a lot of angst and I know emotional things said at microphones. And I think it's important that we acknowledge that the staff is like been an impossible place to be between a whole bunch of groups that care. So I want to thank staff from the microphone just this one time.
Thank you. Any addition or comments? Zach?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Zach Cliver. Work as a whale watch naturalist for Bar Harbor Whale Watch Company in Bar Harbor, Maine, and I have for 24 years spent most of my summers out on the ocean every day. We take about 60,000 people whale watching every summer from all over the world. We have a staff of about 60. And we're one of many whale watching companies in New England that depend on the herring resource. The issue of midwater trawling is a huge issue for us. On a tour that I was on and leading in 2003, we had, as we were heading offshore, what looked like the biggest school of tuna that we'd ever seen with birds over it. And when we arrived, two pair trawl boats were moving away, herring boats that had just dumped tens of thousands of whiting on the surface of the water. So I've seen what the impact of this fishery can be when mistakes are made. We've heard repeatedly from herring fishermen throughout this process since I've been involved for 10 years that have got up and spoke and said that there have been episodes where we've had cod ends full of seals. We've had major ground fish catches as bycatch, dumping of fish. And we also know from the limited observer data that pilot whales and dolphins are occasionally caught in this fishery. And those are fast swimming animals. So I think that's really important for us to consider today. I want us to not forget that the Maine Lobstermen's Association voted 13-0, their board, to ban midwater trawling and pair trawling in the entire Gulf of Maine. I talked to some of those fishermen who are board members who made that vote, and they understand that they need fish as bait, and they don't want this resource wasted. It's a precious resource. And when you consider this as a linchpin, as a keystone species, what it supports, we're talking about probably a $1 billion lobster fishery. We're talking about a tremendous ground fishery, recreational fisheries, tuna fishing industry, a national wildlife refuge system, ecotourism. And tourism is Maine's most important industry, which we're part of. It's a $7 billion industry, and it outweighs all of agriculture, forestry, and fisheries put together. So it's an enormous industry that is dependent on this fish. You know, this helps support all that industry. We need to have the 100% observer coverage, and if you do the math per trip, what these boats bring in and how much they're able to charge for the fish, I feel that there is money for the industry to fund this, and what, you know, for whatever they need to do, they need to be able to put up the money to support this 100% funding, minus whatever the government can put up each year. If the industry pays 325 of these, as they have proposed, if they only pay 325, that still leaves probably more than 70% to the agency to pay. And we know the agency has never had 70% that much money to spend on hearing observer coverage. Right? So if the industry doesn't pay, then the agency can't, and the whole thing becomes useless. If you require the industry to pay whatever the agency can't, maybe it's 70%, maybe it's 80%, whatever it is each year, then it puts the emphasis on the industry, the midwater trawl industry and the bigger boats, to go to Washington, D.C. and lobby for funding, as well as the other stakeholders. We'd all be working together asking Congress for more money. Okay, so you actually create a partnership with all the groups to go and lobby for funding. If we only have 50% observer coverage, for example, then 50% of the time these boats can do whatever they want, which means that they could potentially fish a lot more aggressively. They could fish near the bottom. They could fish on marine mammals and on schools of fish that they may not know that they're hearing. So I think it ruins the 50% of data you do have. Okay, if you have only 50% coverage, you need 100% coverage to make this data worth anything, because this is not a fixed gear fishery. These are mobile boats that can go where they need to go and do whatever they want. Lastly, I want to say that we, in Amendment 1, we submitted 20,000 signatures from people that went on our trips in support of the 100% observer coverage. So this is something we talk about every day on the boats when people come with us. It's a huge issue for us, and I think we have the chance to really, I'm excited today for you. You have a chance, an opportunity to set a foundation for this fishery and for the Gulf of Maine to become much more stable. And in 10 years and 20 years, we're going to reap the benefit from what happens today. So thank you.
Thank you. I can't see. Yeah.
Morning. My name is Darren Saletta. I am a commercial fisherman from Cape Cod, not Timbuktu. And I am also the director of the Massachusetts Commercial Striped Bass Association. I'm not going to bog you down with a bunch of details and too many numbers this morning. We've submitted our comments, and these meetings can be boring enough as is. This is, you guys know what needs to be done today. I've heard these claims of clean fishery, not much dumping and whatnot. Well, I've been there. I've been on the water fishing a hook and line fishery out to the 3-mile line off Cape Cod. And the day the season closes, seeing these boats come in, and here we are fishing responsibly, releasing live fish, catching our quota. Every fish is counted. Everyone's weighed. Same protocol for all fishermen. And you see these boats come through with nets the size of football fields and just clean the place out. You know they're getting striped bass because I've seen them. I've seen them belly up. Haddock, juvenile cod. I go down the outer beaches all the time. Hardly ever see a whale. On the beach, that is. See them all the time offshore. Playing, frolicking, eating, jumping, having a great time. Doing their thing. And then all of a sudden, we see them washed up. A couple days after these boats have come through. Coincidence? Possibly. This vote today is, you know, it's been a long process, been a long road. You've heard thousands and thousands of comments, mostly saying the same thing. accountability, coverage, the same type of regulations that all of us other fishermen deal with. So today, this vote's about small communities, small boat fishermen, the hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands of small boat fishermen in New England. And just do the right thing. You know what needs to be done today. I know there's a lot of mixed interests. I know there's a lot of money involved. But there's a lot of families. There's a lot of fishermen involved, too. And I hope you'll represent us today, because we need this vote. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else? Ian?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the council. I'm in favour. I'm a herring fisherman, Tom Midwaronitz. We're in favour of 100% coverage because we need to clear the air of all the lies that's been spoken over the last 5 years. Give us 100% coverage. We want it. We will clear the air. And a lot of people just... No, I don't want to go there. One thing you got to keep in mind, this herring stock is growing so fast because 15 years ago we were taking over 100,000 ton of herring out of Area 1A, well over 100,000 ton. Now we're taking probably 18% of that. On top of that, we've added spawning closures to protect the spawning stock, which I think was a great thing that was proposed by the herring fishermen. And if you think for 1 minute that this huge biomass, we've steamed over 40 miles of herring without ever coming out of it, 15 fathom deep. Now, I'm not a scientist, but I'm sure some people can add those figures up. If you think that this biomass that's going totally out of hand is not going to affect your ground fish stock in the Gulf of Maine, you're dreaming. You will never, ever rebuild it. Just think about what we got right now. We've got a huge stock of lobsters because there's no codfish to eat them. Codfish love lobsters. We've got a huge stock of dogfish because they don't have a common predator. And we've got a huge stock of herring. What's happening to all the other stocks? They're going down the tube. And they're going to keep going down the tube until you guys make proper decisions on herring management. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, I'm going to bring it back.
Good morning. I'm Margaret Miner with Rivers Alliance of Connecticut, caught on the bridge at Wiscasset. Probably has happened to you guys. Apologies for late. I just wanted to say that in Connecticut we have made a major investment in taking down dams, opening our rivers. There are many jobs, many people at stake here, and we hope to see a nice return of river herring and shad. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Owen Rochford. I work for Norpil. We process herring and mackerel whenever we can get them. I'm totally against 100% observer coverage. A few years ago, we had very close to 100% observer coverage going to George's Banks, and we already informed council that we were having a haddock bycatch problem. Now, we were allowed a 2% cap on haddock, and council decided to cut it to 0.2% because they reckoned that was the level of coverage we had. Now, because there was a rule brought in that if we went into the ground fish closed area, we had to have 100% observer coverage, the boats going to George's that particular year were very close to 100% observer coverage. Yet, they never gave us back the haddock quota to reflect the 100% observer coverage. So we actually had to stop fishing that year as a result of catching a very minuscule bycatch of haddock. It wound up bankrupting two boats that I used to manage. the boat's no longer in the herring fishery. Now, since 2006, or just before 2006, two charitable trusts and other multinational organisations have donated money to Cape Cod Hook & Line Choir, Herring Alliance, and they basically went after the midwater boats in Amendment 1 and got them banned out of Area 1A. Now, this was just a social issue. I mean, there was no conservation of stocks in it. At the time, we felt we could survive on George's and in Area 2, so we never pursued the matter. I guess we had 30 days to sue NIMS, or the Secretary of Commerce. No, we're not litigators. We're commercial fishermen. We're not out to destroy the environment. We're out to have a sustainable fishery, and it is sustainable based on the quotas that we're allowed to catch. However, this whole thing backfired on us because of a bycatch on haddock, and we were given a restrictively small quota. Now, we had 100% observer coverage, and nobody acknowledges the fact that there was little or no interaction with any other ground fish species other than haddock. Now, I've written in comments already to this council that haddock really aren't a ground fish. They're defined as such, but they're not on the ground. Like, for example, cod or any of the flatfish that are out there, more often than not, they're up 3 or 4, anything from about 10 to 30 feet off the bottom. And that's why, from time to time, they may come in contact with a midwater net. But the year in question, there was actually 3 incidences, and there was over 100 tows made. Now, that hardly constitutes like catching ground fish all the time, like all these detractors have said earlier this morning. There's very little, there's no documented evidence from the observer program that shows that we're catching all these ground fish, like cod, and God only knows what else they're saying. So what you're going to wind up doing is you're going to wind up disenfranchising the smaller fishing boats. Now, I'm not talking Group C and D. I'm talking Group A boats that are 55 to 100 feet that carry small quantities of fish in this fishery. When I say small quantities, I'm talking anywhere from 20,000 pounds to 100,000 pounds, because they're not going to be able to afford the observer coverage. The end result is me as a processor, because I don't have a dog in the fight anymore, I'm going to be put out of business because I won't have fish to keep my plant going. Now, that isn't conservation. That's downright blackguarding, because we have the DEM coming down to our plant inspecting for any bycatch. We have the US Coast Guard that inspects the boat when they're at sea regularly to see if there's bycatch. We have the At Sea Observer Program observing to see if there's bycatch. This last winter, we had about 80% coverage from the Department of Fisheries in Massachusetts on a dockside observation program, and they didn't find any bycatch. Now, the bottom line is, if you want to give us or give the industry 100% observer coverage, I'd like to see all these departments indicted for not doing their job. Because as far as I'm concerned, they were doing their job. They were doing a very good job at it. And it's not anecdotal information. It's documented fact. If you take the time to view it, you'll see it's nothing but a way of placing financial burden on industry to cripple them and hopefully eliminate them. That's what the millions of Pew dollars can do. Please take this into account before you pass 100% observer coverage that the industry, the smaller boats particularly, cannot afford. And me as a processor, it'll put me out of business, because once the small boats go out of business, there'll be too few people left catching the resource. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else? Okay, we're coming back to the council. Doug.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's time to start putting some of the committee motions up on the screen here. Our first committee motion was to recommend to the council as a preferred alternative for Section 3.2.1, Alternative 2, 100% coverage for Category A and B and C herring vessels, coupled with the herring AP recommendation for funding option number 2, federal and industry funds, with a maximum contribution of $325 per day by the fishing industry, and option 2, to authorize state as service providers. That's a committee motion, so it doesn't need a second.
The discussion. Terry Stockwell.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Reflecting back after the committee meeting and listening to many members of the audience speak, I've got a motion to amend. And that, Joan, would be on coverage on category in A, B, vessels only. So delete A and C.
Is there a second to that? Glenn? Terry?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This motion, the entire motion, was the outcome of a very lengthy committee discussion. At first, the committee made a motion was specific to A and B. Category C was added, and at least from my perspective, was going to be played out by what the committee's final recommendations were going to be for the river herring measures. For the overall herring monitoring component of this amendment, I don't believe inclusion of sea permits are necessary to adequately monitor the fishery, and I agree with almost all the comments that the audience has made.
Dave Preble, then Jim Odlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, Terry took the words out of my mouth. I was going to make the same motion. I agree with him completely on it. The A and B vessels are directed fishery. They catch close to 98% of the resource that's taken. And the sea vessels have a little under 2% and are an incidental catch group. So I support this motion, and I will vote that way. Thank you.
Jim Odlin.
Yeah, I have a question for Terry or maybe Laurie. Would the C and D boats still be covered under the SBRM, and would they still have to give notice, you know, that you call in so that they can be have a SBRM observer or NEFOP observer put on board?
Terry?
Yeah, thank you, Jim. My recollection is we didn't specifically talk about that at the committee, but that would be my sense. I mean, that it's not that C and D boats are not going to be monitored, but they're not going to be monitored at the 100% coverage that the A and B vessels will be.
Follow-up, Jim?
Yeah, just the reason I ask that is I predict that if you take these options that the C&D percentage of the catch will go up. It just always does when you do something like this, so that I think it's important to monitor them at some level.
Mary Beth.
I certainly do agree with all of Jimmy's comments, and I also agree with the intent of the maker of the motion and support the motion. I think that, if you want to cover Category C vessels, it depends on what your goals and objectives are for the program, and we have not identified any goals and objectives for an industry-funded program or even an agency-funded program, but certainly the costs are of great concern to those of us who operate in the directed fishery with Category A, and they increase quite a bit if you're a Category C vessel. So, in general, I think that to the extent we can monitor C vessels, we should do it. But as far as the 100%, I...
Mark Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support the amendment to remove the Category C vessels. I think it's important, given limited funding, to concentrate what available funding there is, where the bang for the buck is the greatest. A couple of questions, maybe the devil's in the detail, don't need to be worked out now, but it's still not clear to me how the two pots of money, industry funded, supported funds and agency funds, can come together. I thought I heard at the committee that that's actually not possible, that industry money can't flow to the agency. It's not clear to me how those pots of money are going to come together to pay for a trip, given that 325 apparently doesn't cover it. So maybe that's just the devil to be worked out in the details later, but I certainly support sharing the burden. It just wasn't clear to me at the committee that we knew how that was actually going to happen. And then the final point I make is I did hear in, I think, Lori's presentation that it was understood or expected that the states as service providers would meet all the same requirements as the current providers, and that's the intent of the motion here. All right, thank you.
Sally McGee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support the motion to amend. I think we need to consider how far we've come in this discussion about paying for observer coverage. Just a couple of years ago, we couldn't even have a conversation about industry paying for observer coverage. So I fully support this motion. It's the direction we need to go in the herring fishery. It's the direction we need to go for monitoring across all the fisheries that we're engaged in. Thank you.
Tom Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support the amendment, and I support the change, and as Sally just said, I think it is important to recognize how different this conversation is and appreciate the industry stepping up. My question, in addition to the clarification that Mark Gibson asked for, just to make sure that the state, as service providers, are beholden to all the same transparency and data requirements as every other service provider. As long as that's clear, I don't have a problem with that. In terms of the 325, it's not clear to me whether the council can set that as a cost or as a target. I think we can take measures to reduce costs, whether through approved third-party providers, other sort of measures that we can take to make this program cost-effective. But I think we can target $325 a day, but I don't think we can set an actual dollar figure any more than we could do that in groundfish. These services cost what they cost. They're third-party providers. So I think that perhaps that detail needs to be worked out, but to me, I simply don't see how we can cap a dollar figure. I think we need to target a dollar figure and take measures to cap costs. So perhaps that's something that we can work on.
Dave Preble.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't address that issue because we had a motion to amend, and I was addressing just that. But since that issue has come up, on the 325 per day, I agree with what Tom Dempsey said. I think we're not well served by giving an exact number, but I like the way we did that with groundfish, and as a matter of policy, I think that these plans should all, if we're going to address shared costs, I think that they should all be in consilience. I would rather see, rather than 325 per day, I'd rather see the wording that was used by groundfish, where the herring vessels are responsible for the direct costs, which would come out to about $325 a day, but we wouldn't be putting an exact number on it. I can't remember who brought that up. It might have been Tom, actually. And I would prefer to see that approach. I don't know how to do that structurally here. I think we take care of this amendment first would be what I would expect.
I would say to park that idea till we get this done. Rodney.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had the same concerns as Mark Gibson had, how the money could flow between the industry and the agencies and the state agencies, but I think that needs to be worked out as we flush this out.
Frank Blount.
Yeah, thank you. My comments are going to be on the 325, too, so I'll wait to see if this passes, and then it'll be on the main motion.
I have David Pierce next.
Initially, at the herring committee meeting, I had supported the inclusion of the sea vessels. However, after reading additional public comment that's been provided to us in writing, and of course after listening to the comments today, after reflecting on the presentation given by the service yesterday regarding observer costs, cost of the program, it does seem sensible to delete C from consideration, so I would support this particular motion. And with regard to the amount of money that would be set aside, well, there would be the maximum contribution to be provided by the fishing industry, the 325. I do support being very specific, especially since it was made very clear during the public hearing testimony and also in writing that the industry, the herring industry, was supporting 100% observer coverage, which they felt was a concession on their part, provided the $325, the West Coast cost of observing, as they defined it, was part of the package. So, to me, there was a linkage there, and I still want to maintain that linkage, especially since one of the overarching objectives that we have for hearing management continues to be our being sensitive to the needs of the sea herring fishery, and in particular our desire to continue to work cooperatively with them to maintain a very good working relationship. That's one of our overarching objectives that certainly has been made evident through the move-along strategy that the industry has played a major role in developing and in implementing. So the main motion, once we, assuming this passes and we delete C, when we get to the main motion, I would still support the inclusion of the 325, recognizing that this is not going to be an easy task to finally implement this, to find all the money to do the necessary, to have the necessary funding for the 100% observers.
I have Mary Beth, then Glenn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Certainly there's a lot of angst about the 325, and it is odd to be so specific, and I think everybody understands that this is not a number that's going to have a lot of longevity. I mean, costs for everything from a slice of bread changes over time. It is a marker. It makes a statement. It says this is what we can afford to pay. The current costs of the program are not affordable for anybody in the region. There was a reference to groundfish. That's a great reference. Groundfish industry can't afford any of it, hasn't paid for any of it, because, quite frankly, not the largest boat, not the smallest boat. Nobody can afford to fish if they have to pay for it. The only industry in the region we have that's paying anything for an observer day is a scallop boat. Well, we have scallop boats. And we are paying it. However, there's a program in place that compensates the vessel so that there's a reimbursement, and it's a wash. So this would be the first program in which we actually are contemplating the industry paying right up front. And we say we can pay $325. There's going to be the agency says we don't even know how to take your $325. That's a major discussion that went on at the Mid-Atlantic last week, and there was no resolution to it. And so the Mid-Atlantic Council said, we're just moving this because we're not going to solve it today. We need the contract lawyers at the table. We needed all kinds of stuff. This is a statement the council can make and say, you know what? We think the industry should pay. The industry says we want to pay. We want 100% observer coverage. We're not going to resolve all these issues that the public has raised without it. But we have to be reasonable. And what is the process we're going to have going forward to resolve it? We're going to have to figure that out. But what can we decide today? What can this council decide today that is the right thing to do? So forget about the contract lawyers. Forget about all those issues. Just make the right decision. So the right decision is to support the committee motion and move it forward. The industry says we're happy to kick in, but we have to kick in at a level that we can afford to untie the lines. We have to be able to fish. If we go at $750 a day, if we go at $1,200 a day, I mean, you look at the options in the document. It says, you know, in 2007, the industry had 1,700 days at sea. Well, we have two boats that we operate out of Rockland, Maine, and those two boats combine for approximately 400 days a year. So we are probably the most active company in the industry. And at $750 a day, the owner of our company and his family says we tied to the dock. So what do we want at the end of the day? And it's not going to be perfect. We're not going to resolve all these issues today, but we need to support the committee motion.
Glenn.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I support taking the seaboats out. And as far as the 325, we're using numbers that are based on government mandates trying to tell private industry what needs to be done. I think, and it's probably going to be a long process, but we've got to find a way to let the private sector come up with, you know, the observer companies and the fleet come up with an acceptable way to do this at a reasonable price based on what the fleet can afford, do a complete business analysis without a whole bunch of mandates put in there that's going to inflate the price. Then we'll get to a real price that the fleet can afford for all the fisheries. And I don't know what it's going to take to do that, but I have a problem with setting a number at this point. Thank you.
Doug Grout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for the record, I also support this motion to amend. The sea vessels are a very different category. They're not a directed fishery. They're an incidental fishery. They make up between 1 and 2% of the entire herring harvest. And the cost as shown in the document on page 393 to these vessels would be 2 to 3 times larger per their amount of revenue that they take in than the other of the A and B vessels. So I think by focusing on the directed fishery with this, I think we will be getting the information that we need and that they want to prove that this is a clean fishery. So I support this motion.
Dave Gaethel.
I have a couple of questions, actually. Going back to Jimmy's comment about the SBRM fleets, I looked that up. It says New England Midwater Trawl, Mid-Atlantic Midwater Trawl, and New England Purse Seine. So I assume that's what he's referring to. There's nothing in here that says anything about mandatory registration. So I think we've got to clarify that. And it's somewhat irrelevant to this motion because it's not in the motion, but we're going to have to come back to that. The other question I had was actually for Lori. It says Mid-Atlantic Council motion for industry-funded mackerel amendment, and it says that there's a review after 2 years. Is that how is that proposed to work? Is that like a sunset clause, or is it some kind of amorphous review?
It's not a sunset because it doesn't go away. But the Mid-Atlantic Council's motion related to this issue included that the coverage levels would be reviewed every 2 years. So my assumption is that their FMAT would review them, but I'm sure that Mr. Robbins can clarify that. Just on the first question before I stop, with the relationship to the SBRM, just to clarify, I mean, this motion is for permit categories, so this would be 100% coverage on A and B. What we did in the document, in the analysis, because there were some alternatives that related to the SBRM coverage levels, we looked at the relationship of the SBRM fleets to the A and B and C permit holders, and we found that for the fleets that you mentioned, the New England Midwater Trawl, the Mid-Atlantic Midwater Trawl, and the New England Purse Seine, those fleets have a lot of overlap with our A and B permit holders. So when you're looking at SBRM allocations and things, those three fleets represent a good component or a good percentage of the A and B permit holders. But relative to this alternative, the A and B permit holders would be subject to 100% observer coverage. So that would trump their SBRM allocations or whatever. The more restrictive requirements would apply to these permit holders. So they would be subject to 100%. The rest of the fleet and the rest of the SBRM fleets would continue to have whatever baseline allocations are given through the SBRM or whatever process in the future we have for allocating coverage across our fisheries. And similarly, with the mackerel motion, the way that we talked about it with the PDT and the FMAT is that if there's a mackerel boat, for example, that has a herring permit and a mackerel permit and is subject to different observer coverage requirements because of those two permits, the more restrictive requirements would apply. And then I just, if you want other clarification, I guess I would turn to Mr. Robbins on the Mid-Atlantic Council's motion.
Chairman Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of points. One, with respect to the review, we did adopt a motion that would require a review every 2 years of the observer coverage levels. I would anticipate that would start out with a staff-level review that would then flow through the committee and ultimately to the council for discussion and consideration. I wanted to point out, though, with respect to the 325, we had a very similar discussion to what you all are having today, when we convened last week to consider this question. We recognized that there were a lot of elements of a cost-sharing program and details that had yet to be worked out. The program doesn't exist yet, so obviously there are a lot of details that need to be spelled out and developed. But as we came to the point of concluding this amendment, we didn't want to lose the opportunity to express our preference for what we thought might be an appropriate outcome for a cost-sharing model. So we did go ahead and put in the figure of 325. That was the value that had been proffered by the industry and discussed at the committee level. But we also made that amount subject to modification through the specification process. We recognize it may not be static. The cost factors may change over time, and it may be necessary to change that in the future. So we did include a provision that we could change that through specifications. We recognize there were a lot of elements that needed to be worked out. For example, Mark Gibson asked a question about how can the two pots of money come together, because we did hear agency concerns about their ability to pay for a fraction of the same C-day that the industry may be paying for. So we recognize that there are caveats and open questions about that, and it may be that the industry ends up paying for the equivalent percentage of days that relates back to 325. Again, those details have to be worked out, but we set it up so it could be modified through specifications. And again, we were expressing our preference for what we thought was an appropriate cost-sharing model that would support the monitoring program that we wanted to see advance.
Thank you, Becca. You, Dave?
Yeah. I'm not going to add anything on to this motion because I think I'd rather see it clean, but I think that the council should consider some kind of review process. If after 2 years, you basically find no smoking gun, do you want to saddle people with this in perpetuity? I think the Mid-Atlantic's approach is a reasonable one, that there's some kind of review. So I'll just leave that out there as an open question. I think it may be the subject of another amendment before we're done here.
Jim, I join the list, did you? Anyone else? Jim.
Thank you. I would like to just get some clarification on the motion regarding the relationship between the observer coverage, 100%, and the SBRM amendment. I know that Lori just indicated that the more restrictive coverage would trump the other, and I just wanted to make sure that everyone agreed to that interpretation and perhaps get that into the record, because when it comes time for the Science Center to do the SBRM allocation, this question will certainly come up, and so it would be good to know the intent.
Lori, do you have any further comment on that from what you said before? Okay. Mark?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with this amendment. I think that 100% observer coverage for Category C vessels is neither statistically necessary or affordable by those permit categories. Thank you.
Anyone else on the council? Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick comment. ASMSC submitted a letter on May 10th from Vince O'Shea to Dan Morris with the ASMSC perspective on all the issues that the council is going to talk about today. And the concepts that are in the main motion, the 100% observer coverage and the cost sharing between industry and the service, as well as the states as authorized service providers, are consistent with the commission's position. I'm not going to read through it on each of these motions. I just want to point out that letter is in your background material, and the states here, obviously, in the New England region can represent their position in a lot more detail than is in this letter, but the other states, the Mid-Atlantic and the South Atlantic, also provided input, and the comments in this letter are consensus statements of all the states up and down the coast. So just, if folks are wondering what the ASMSC perspective is, I'm happy to provide that, but I think the letter, speaks for itself, and so I won't comment on each of the motions that are made. Thank you, Rip.
Thank you. Council, seeing no further comment, I will call a question on a motion to amend. All those in favor so indicate. Fifteen in favor. Opposed. Abstention. One. Recusal, one. The motion carries 15-0-1-1. Sticking to our 90-minute break scenario, this seems to be a good time. We will take a 10-minute break and then come back and continue. script.
Who's that guy?
Council members, back to the table. Conversations in the back of the room. If you need to continue them, please take them outside. We are on the main motion as amended. Tom Dempsey.
Well, people rushed back. I actually just took a bite of my little snack bar, so sorry. I actually wanted to see whether the maker of this motion would allow for a friendly amendment along the lines of what we were just talking about, which was to include the word target before maximum contribution. And I think the reason for that is just to allow us, as we work out the details in implementing this program, as much flexibility to get the job done and keep the cost down as possible.
Yeah, I would consider that a great perfection and friendly to dinner.
It's... No. Okay, the maker and the seconder of the, everybody's okay with that. Okay. Well, I'll just do it without objection. Discussion. Terry Stockwell and Jim Odlin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. We've had significant discussion both at the committee and at the council about the first two measures. I just want to underscore that my intent was that the states must comply with all the service provider requirements and report out to the council and the audience that the Maine DMR does have a NEFOP-trained observer.
Thank you. Jim Odlin.
Well, I have a couple of questions here. One is... This seems to be a mandated 100% coverage. You know, my question is, what if the funding is not available to cover 100%? That's question one. Number two is, how can the service implement the difference between the $700 a day and the $325 a day? So I guess Lori can tee me off on that, or Gene or somebody.
Phil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can try and speak to this. There are various different pieces of this puzzle, obviously, and as the chairman of the MID mentioned, we still have some unanswered questions with respect to how we would make this work. And we want to do the best that we can to make it work as well. But these questions about how to bring industry and agency money together to purchase observer sea days is a complicated one. And we think at this point that the only way that we could make it work would be for the industry to in some way accumulate money and purchase entire sea days from the observer provider. And at the same time, the agency, if funds were available, would be able to purchase sea days. But the concern that we have here is that while we do have, we expect to have the infrastructural funds available to support within the agency the care and feeding of observers, training, debriefing, equipment, data management, on all of that, we're unable to identify additional funds to support the coverage need. And so our thinking is that this idea that's on the table about targets is really a good one, a good way to think about it. And just to come back to this issue of cost, somebody in the earlier discussion around the amendment suggested that one way to do this is simply to set things up so that there is an independent negotiation between the industry, whatever industry entity there is, and the observer provider. and that would set the price, and that would be completely independent of the agency, and that, I think, is technically the way that would work out. We wouldn't set, there's no way that the agency could set a price that the industry, for which the industry would purchase observer days at sea from a private company. There would just need to be a negotiation and a contract that was set up for the provision of observers to support the industry's funding.
Jim?
Okay, I think I understand that part, but the first question I had was, you know, is this a 100% target, a target of 100%, or a mandatory 100%, so that if the combined funding of the service and the industry only reaches 99% or 90% or even 80%, does that mean people don't go? That's the question I have in the wording right here. So I'd feel better if it's at a target of 100% coverage. At least we're not tying the industry up if something happens and there's not quite enough funding.
Mary Beth, I got Frank Brown first.
Yeah, I think Mary Beth probably has the answer to that one. But the my question, I'm gonna go here someplace. It says a target maximum, which is kind of an odd phrase. But if we're going to go with the maximum of 325, and I know that's only the target, is that going to be frameworkable in the amendment, or a year from now, do we have to have a new amendment, or how do you change the 325 if that's the maximum? Would have to be, I don't want to have to do a whole new amendment to change that if we approve it. Is it specifications?
Gene?
Yeah, I think it was suggested earlier that the Mid-Atlantic, I think, dealt with this by including the coverage in as part of the specifications package. But you need to be clear, if that's what you intend, you would need to be clear that that should be specified every year or every period that you're doing your specifications for.
If I can, yeah, I think I'm the one that brought it up at the mid. So it's my interpretation by this that we'd be the same thing as the mid and that we could do it in the specs package. And if there's no objection to that, I'd rather not change the motion, but if that's everybody's interpretation.
To that comment, are people comfortable with that? So without objection, that would be the intent of this? Okay. Mary Beth?
I think that there's a number of issues that we're not going to be able to resolve today. And the conversation we had at the Mid-Atlantic last week on this, we needed to have, like, contract lawyers at the table to advise us, and came to the conclusion that wasn't going to happen during our discussion. And so that is how the MID came to their final decision-making process. The 325, just for anyone who's not really familiar with where this number comes from. We at O'Hara's have vessels that operate in the Bering Sea. We have two observers on all three of our boats, 24/7. We sign contracts with third-party providers at $325 a day. That's the current rate. We have no expectation that rate is going to continue through time. It's a negotiated rate. It's here as a placeholder. This is where we in the region need to get to. I mean, not just for herring, but for everybody. And so it makes a statement. There's a bunch of issues. I think we do need to figure out, you know, I don't know if we'll figure it out by the end of the day, but, you know, what's the process that's going to get everybody in the Northeast region here? We're talking about herring today, but this is where we all need to go. We've asked a number of times as this action has developed, you know, why? Why are we paying $325 on vessels that their gross income is, you know, combined greater than the entire industry here on the East Coast in herring? Why, you know, why does a pollock boat that grosses $20 million a year pay $325? And here in New England, we want to, you know, ask vessels to pay $750 a day, and the total industry together in aggregate is less than a single boat that's paying this. We just want equity across, you know, the fisheries in the nation. There's issues. I mean, we're not going to resolve them today. And if we could identify what the process is moving forward to resolve them, we'd be, you know, light years ahead of where we were when we started this morning. So I don't have the answers. Frank says, oh, Mary Beth must have the answers. I really don't. I don't have the answers. So if we could just identify some process that's going to help us get there before we, you know, finish out this discussion today, we'd be way ahead of the game.
Dave Gato, then Doug Grau.
Well, I would suggest two things. First, on the process, I think you really need to convene, you know, the service will have to convene some kind of a workshop to draw all these people together, the Science Center, Nero, the industry, the lawyers. You know, whoever goes into making these contracts has to sit down in a room and decide how to actually get this done. The second point is to the issue of a target contribution. And I think that the reason it says that to me is there, you know, some boats don't fish. As an example, we were told in Groundfish that observers are paid somewhere between, as I remember, $16 and $20.80 an hour. So if a boat goes out for 6 hours, he shouldn't have to pay for 24 hours worth of coverage. He wouldn't pay $325. But if a boat's gone for 24 hours, the maximum he could be charged was $325. But these types of things need to be solved by, you know, whoever writes the contract. I mean, these are all details of a contract that goes on between the observer company and the industry. I agree with everybody that says that we can't solve those here today. I don't know. Maybe there's contract lawyers in the room. I can't, you know, they don't wear a hat that says contract lawyer, so I don't know. But, you know, it's not me, and it's not this council. And I don't see how we can do much more than lay out the concept, and then somebody else has got to convene a workshop that does the nuts and bolts.
Doug Grout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Concerning potential modification in the future of at least the amount, the targeted maximum amount, I see under Section 3.5, and you can look at this on page 19 of the decision document, that provisions related to the industry-funded catch monitoring program are under the list of measures that can be frameworked under this amendment. So as long as we're clear that that can be changed in the future under a framework. The other minor point that I wanted to bring up, and this may apply to a lot of the motions, we have motions here that all say recommend to the council. Well, clearly, as the council makes the decision here, we're going to be recommending to NIMS. And I don't know if we want to just make that as a general friendly from the committee chair at the beginning here, that, you know, as we bring these up, if we're going to approve it, it's going to be recommending to NIMS.
I think probably the proper language would be adopt as a preferred alternative.
I was just going by how the MID had worded their motions, and they said recommend the National Marine Fisheries Service as a preferred preferred alternative. But
Tom Dempsey, then I'm going to change how we take comments.
Excuse me. I was simply going to say that I think, as I read the alternative, as I've heard a warming comment both from the industry and from other stakeholders, 100% means 100%, just like it works in other fisheries that have 100% on the West Coast and how it works in closed area one. So I think that's the alternative that we're talking about here. And I was going to ask that we move the question. I think we do have an awful lot of things to work out as we go forward along the day. But I think we need to dispose of this motion and move forward on other issues.
Button.
Well, just going back to Jimmy's question, just to put a different spin on it, you know, the agency has no problem, I don't think, assuming that it can be justified, approving 100% observer coverage if it means, as Tom was suggesting, that a vessel doesn't go out unless it has an observer on board. If this amendment, I mean, if this motion is intended to obligate the agency to pay for 100%, or at least the difference between $325 a day and 100%, then obviously the agency cannot agree, cannot approve a requirement to obligate itself to pay money that it doesn't have and doesn't know if it's going to have. But we can reasonably agree to require 100% observer coverage if the intent is that a vessel doesn't go out unless it has the observer, regardless of how much funding is available. So that needs to be clearly stated. Is that the intent of this motion, that if the agency can't fund up to 100%, that a vessel doesn't go out without an observer?
Tom?
I think we're going to have a conversation about that point, but my understanding is that 100% means 100%. I don't understand really why observer coverage or monitoring is unique in this case with regards to the agency's position. Whether we're making VMS necessary or a reporting requirement, many of the changes and requirements that we enact here at the council cost money on the backside, and no, we don't have control over the budget. What we're saying here is, as a policy, we want 100% coverage on A and B permits, and I think it's pretty straightforward from where I sit. So, again, I think we should deal with this, continue on with the rest of the discussions that we have in a full day.
Are you calling for moving the question?
Yes.
Okay. That's non-debatable. Yeah. So we're going to take the first vote is on whether to adopt moving the question. All those in favor, so indicate.
No, I'm going to vote no.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. 14 in favor. Opposed? One. Abstention? One. Recusal? One. So it's 14, 1, 1, 1. Motion carries. Okay.
Because the question wasn't answered except by Tom, but there was no objection. That motion means that a vessel, as it now stands, if the agency can't fund 100% observer coverage, an A and B vessel cannot go out fishing unless it has an observer. Is that understood by the council?
Lori.
Yeah, to this point, and this is kind of the question that's raised in the decision document, I think this motion is clear in terms of what the council is recommending as a requirement in Amendment 5, and this motion gives some direction on how to develop the industry-funded component of the monitoring program. So I'm comfortable with the motion, but to Gene's point, I think that it's going to be imperative after this motion passes for the council to recognize that the industry-funded component of this monitoring program is probably not going to be online on January 1st. So there needs to be some direction given to me and I guess to the agency as to how the council intends to have these requirements implemented and what's going to happen during the transition period. I'm very concerned about developing this amendment and working through the final document and having the amendment disapproved and returned to us because the agency cannot approve a requirement that can't be funded. So if this motion passes, I would just encourage the council to clarify what the intent is with respect to the interim period until the industry-funded monitoring component comes online.
Lori, do you think that this part of it is, I want to say, parkable until we get through this section and see what else we do and then deal with it before we move to the next, to the FMP adjustments?
Well, I think after this motion passes, it's the next question. This motion actually addresses the issues of service providers and the general funding issues. So I think really this is the next issue.
I'm sorry, Lori. I didn't hear a single word you said.
My response was that if this motion passes, I think that's the very next issue that the council needs to address.
Thank you. There's no further debate. We've got to vote on this one. Okay. All those in favor of the motion? Fourteen in favor. Opposed? One. Abstention? One. Recusal? One. 14. 1-1-1. Okay. Mary Beth.
So I don't disagree with the intent of the motion that just passed, and I think that we all have an understanding of what it is. I think Lori's, you know, described, you know, we need to develop some interim process. The reality of the motion that passes is that, you know, we have no way to get the funds. You know, we have no industry-funded program. We need to move something to the agency that they can implement. This is not really, they don't have a way to do that. And at the committee meeting, I had a suggestion in interim process, and, you know, I'm not going to make motions today. I'm not voting on motions today, but we've got to come up with something. I mean, if you feel that 100% is the right number, and this action gets implemented in January of 2013, and we all stay tied to the dock, well, if that's people's intent, then I guess I'm good with that. We just won't go fishing, but that's kind of where we're at the moment.
Dr. Pierce, you have a solution.
I had assumed that the next motion would address this particular issue. I don't see it reflected in the decision document on page 3 down into the text, but it's right at the second motion, hearing committee motion, about a waiver for an at-sea observer to be granted for a fishing trip, et cetera, et cetera. That's the second motion in the list on page 3. It would seem to me that if that motion is made, and the committee chair will make that motion on behalf of the committee, that if this passes, then that would deal with the fact that this particular program would not be, or a requirement would not be in place on January 1, 2013. Waivers would have to be issued, as opposed to telling a fishing vessel, you can't go fishing, which is unreasonable. The waivers would be granted until we get everything in place. Except, of course, there would be no waiver for trips that would be in areas and at times with measures associated to avoid or protect river herring. That would be key. So that's the next motion to be made, and I think it addresses the point, Mary Beth's point, your point, Gene's point.
I understand your comment. I'm not sure it necessarily deals with Gene's concern on this, because I think the intent of the waiver was that it would be the exception, not the rule, so to speak. Do you, Lori, have any suggestion as to some language that would get us out of this bind?
Probably not, but I can try. And this was a suggestion that I had made at the committee meeting, and I'm still not entirely clear on whether or not this approach is possible, but on page 22 of the public hearing document, the two options for funding are laid out in the document, including the language under the specific options. We've chosen funding option 2, which is a combination of federal and industry funds. And my question at the committee meeting and my initial suggestion, and I'm still not clear as to whether or not this is possible, is that maybe one approach is to adopt funding option 2 with the provisions that we've adopted and go ahead and start laying out the industry-funded component of the monitoring program, but in the meantime, fall back on option 1. in the document and adopt option one until option two is ready to come online. Option one is no action on the funding, but the specific language under option one says that observer coverage may be desired or targeted at a higher rate, but the realized annual coverage would be based on the allocation of federal resources and would be subject to the prioritization of federal resources. So it is a no-action option, but it recognizes right in the language of the option that we may require higher levels of coverage in the amendment, but that the realized coverage levels would be based on available federal funds. I tried to word it like that so that it would be sort of a fallback if we needed some time to develop an industry-funded program, and I don't know if that, if adopting option one until option two comes online is a viable option. I'm just trying to figure out ways that we can get this through the service and approved.
Doug.
From my perspective, that would could potentially be a viable option in the interim. The question is, do we have a feel for how long it would take to if we couldn't make this January 1, 2013 deadline, that it would take? Could we put like a time limit on it, say 6 months, that the coverage would default to what the NIMS could afford until we could get this back up online? That's one of my questions. And Lori, do you have any thoughts, or does the service have any thoughts as to how long it might take to get an industry-based program up online? You know, my concept is they'd have to be paying into some third-party group who would administer it and then dish out the money for funds for observer coverage.
Dan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll do my best to answer that question and kind of the suite of surrounding questions. So forgive me if I bounce around a bit. This is an important initiative, and we welcome the increase in monitoring in the industry. We welcome the idea and the industry of industry funding and the what appears to be broad industry support for a level of funding. And I don't want the implementation details that I'm about to try to describe to you to suggest that we're opposed to this. But I think we do have to consider the practicalities that the agency and the industry will have to face as this comes forward from the motion into some sort of supporting regulations and associated programs, as well as what does a day look like in operationally. This raises a number of questions, and Dr. Karp spoke to them earlier about accepting money. There is no authority for the government to accept money, so we'd have to come up with Mr. Grout was saying, some third party as a receiver. There would have to be a program under that third party to distribute the C-days. There will need to be some way, and it's unclear whether it would be within the regulatory realm or through some other mechanism to enforce that program and to ensure that it's used properly, to ensure that the days that are supported by those funds have the same quality of service as well as the same surety of happening as they would under the NEFOP program. There's any number of questions. I think we have the implementation of this is going to take a long time to work out in terms of those sorts of programmatic as well as legal details. As those, and perhaps Mr. Capel's idea of a workshop or a series of workshops to get to those solutions is the way to go. We have done that sort of thing before and would welcome it in these sort of big changes in how we're doing business. But that takes a long time. I think 6 months is far too optimistic. I think once those details are worked out, there's going to need to be a supporting action from this council to adopt those details. And ideally, it's consistent with what Mid-Atlantic is doing. So we'd be looking at some sort of framework to specify exactly how we want these programs to happen after the after those details have been described, all the how-to pieces. And so I don't want to speculate on exactly how long it would be, but I think I'd have trouble seeing any of that during bearing fruit in 2013.
Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to that point and understanding some of the agency's concerns, I think we just need to keep this in context of what we're actually talking about here. We have 40% coverage on this fleet right now. They take 625 trips in 2010. We're talking about increasing, just filling that gap to 100. 60% is 375 trips. It's 375 trips, 90% of which come out of four ports. In 2010, we observed 13,000 groundfish trips out of 130 ports. I mean, we know how to put observers on boats. You know, there are 30 active vessels with A and B permits. We know how to do this. It's not the invasion of Normandy. It's just a couple logistical details that we have to iron out. I have to believe that we can do that. It's not going to take multiple years. That timeline, to me, just is all out of whack. We know how to do this. We're going to pass some simple motions. We passed the motion with a clear intent of 100%. I really don't see implementation being as big a challenge as others do. And to my way of thinking, we implement Amendment 5 just like we implement every other action. When it's ready to go, we put it on the water. I really don't feel like this needs trailing actions. I don't think it needs any special considerations. It's fairly straightforward. We're talking about 375 trips a year, effectively. An increase to what we're talking about or what we have on the water in coverage right now. So I think we do need to keep that in mind. My final bit of sort of context to put this in, that 625 trips for the A and B permits, we had more observed trips in 2010 in the fixed gear sector alone than 625. We need to keep the context of what we're actually talking about, what the challenge is, and remind ourselves that we put observers on boats all the time. Implementation isn't going to be the challenge that I think some people worry.
I've got several people on the list. I needed to ask Gene a question. If this stays as it currently is on the board, and it takes, and I'm just going to use that, takes a year and a half for the service to put together and with working with the council to the program and the implementation, what happens in the meantime?
You're talking about the prior motion that was just passed? Well, without any subsequent motion, which people are contemplating, and as Lori pointed out, there is alternatives in here, then a vessel could not go fishing unless it had an observer on board. I mean, right now, all we have that's been adopted on the table is that there must be 100% observer coverage of all A and B herring trips. So if we don't have the funding to do it and the industry's funding contribution is not in place, then we will only be able to fund whatever. And this is we have to keep this in mind. We're developing a new SBRM amendment that gets away from the way we've done this in the past, that takes away discretion, at least the way it's headed now, for allocating more sea days to certain fisheries versus other fisheries. We're now looking at a across-the-board 30% CV maximization policy, which is not what we've been doing in the past. And that is, and Jim raised this earlier, that's a real factor to consider here. This isn't money necessarily that comes off the top. We look at the general funds for the SBRM purposes, and we can't allocate to management needs under that the way that's being contributed. So the bottom line question is, without any further explanation or exemption or waiver, a vessel would have to have an observer, A and B vessel would have to have an observer to go on a herring trip. And if it's not available, the vessel can't go. That's the way I interpret that motion.
Only after the implementation of Amendment 5.
Right. After Amendment 5 is implemented and approved. And we have to consider all of these conflicting problems in deciding what we can approve and what we can't approve as well. So that's assuming that agency approves the motion.
Okay. I've got Glenn, Terry, Mary Beth.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'm just going to make one comment based on testimony this morning. We had industry members getting up and saying that they welcomed 100% observer coverage because there's been a lot of stuff going around about what they're catching. So I think we need to provide that opportunity for them to show that it is indeed a clean fishery if it is. Thank you.
Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Given Gene's explanation, I mean, the concept of tying the vessels to the dock on the first of next year because of an undeveloped program is really unacceptable. So I've got a motion to see if we can't move this along. And I move to adopt 3.2.1, option 1, as a temporary measure until option 2 is the federal industry funding option is fully implemented. The timeline for this measure will be no more than 1 year from the adoption of, from the implementation and approval of Amendment 5.
Is there a second to that? Doug Grout. Discussion. Tom.
I guess I don't see how this necessarily changes what we currently do. I guess it seems like there's an assumption that we'll implement Amendment 5 before we implement Amendment 5 or before we're prepared to do that. If it's not ready to implement, then we don't implement it until it is. I guess this motion, and correct me if I'm wrong, but to this motion it says we're going to do what we currently do until we implement Amendment 5. I think that's what we do in every case, that when we're going to implement an action that makes changes to existing regulations, until we implement that action, with the understanding that it's developed and ready to roll out, then we do what's on the water now. So I guess that's a question. Is the intent of this motion somehow different from that, our normal process?
Lori?
Yeah, my understanding is that the intent of this motion is to allow us to put together a package for the agency that can be approved, first of all, and implemented in the most expeditious manner possible. I think the intent with this is to put in a backstop for the funding option that the service can actually approve with the 100% requirement until option 2 comes online. And I think the concern here is that if you just put the package forward, and, you know, as we've heard, it could take over a year to develop the industry-funded monitoring component. So do we want the whole package just to sit at the agency for a year and a half, and then get approved, I don't know, 2013, 2014, and implemented when that's ready? Or do we want to put in a placeholder that can allow the rest of the package to be implemented at the start of 2013 while we work on the backstop measure that would then replace option one? I mean, I think the idea here is we have a lot of components of this amendment that are ready to go. So let's not hold the whole thing up for another year or 2 years while we develop the industry-funded component of it. While we can go ahead and get all the reporting stuff out there, we can get the trip notification requirements. All the other components of this amendment can be developed, submitted, and implemented January 1. So I think the idea here is to move the process along and put a backstop in so that we can at least get this thing, at least as many components of it as possible, online for next year.
Thank you. Mary Beth, you had your hand up before we got into this. Did you want to comment now? Or
finding it difficult to remember why my hand was up. But initially it was up because I just wanted to clarify Tom's comments on the number of days. And in 2009 it was close to 2,000 days. So it's not like we're trying to make up 300 days. We're trying to make up, you know, like 1,000-plus days. And really, on our discussion yesterday about SBRM, what I brought up to the council was that clearly the process going forward is going to take our discretion away. And if the SBRM changes are going to move forward, which a court decision says they are going to move forward, that if you look at the statistical methodology that's proposed, the coverage in Atlantic Herring is going to, for midwater trawls at approximately 50% in 2011, is likely to drop to less than 10. And so that's where we're at. I mean, and we don't have the discretion to change that in the path that we have before us. And the idea that we would make final decisions today and then at the same time ask the agency, well, don't implement this for 2 years. I actually have had a recent experience in which they haven't implemented a final decision by the council by more than 2 years now. But I don't think that's their normal mode. I don't know how we could do that. I just don't, you know, unless we consider this path that Terry's put forward, I don't know how we move forward. I understand your concerns, but as, you know, as Dan has indicated, we have to be somewhat practical in what we're doing here. And for those reasons, I support the motion.
Gene. Yeah, just to clarify the intent of the motion, is it to basically put in the 100% observer coverage but suspend it until the details are worked out, and that we just basically operate status quo in the meantime? Is that what's intended, Terry? I think that's what you meant, right?
That's correct, Jim.
And we have predicate for that. I mean, when we did VMS requirements, we required them in scallops and groundfish like in 1995, but didn't implement them until several years later when it was possible to make sure that they were operational and functional. So so I think there's a legal basis for doing this.
Terry Stockwell. Doug Grout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to give a brief explanation of why I seconded this motion, is that, as Lori said, there's a lot of other things in this amendment, and I do not want to delay the rest of them because of one component. But I also like Terry's concept of having a backstop. This isn't an infinite amount of delay. I'd ideally like to have this industry-funded program in place by January 1, 2013. But it sounds like it's going to take a little bit more time than that. So we implement, we make sure there's still coverage based on the amount of funds that NIMS has to provide coverage for this industry, for the A and B boats, until then, and then, but we have a backstop that has got to be in place within a year after implementation.
Dave Cahill.
I want to agree with a number of the previous speakers. And my read on this at the moment is if we pass this without some mechanism to bridge the gap, it'll come back as unapprovable. I mean, you read the letter from the service. They say they cannot implement this. They can't collect money from boats. We have, you know, this is what happens when you try and move an amendment forward when you haven't worked out the details. What this says is, with this motion, they will suspend this portion of it for a year while those details are worked out, and then, you know, we're still going to have to come up with an implementation framework or something for those details. But I think this is the only way you can move forward. You can't say you're going to do something that the service can't do and expect anything other than a rejection of that portion of the amendment. That's just a given. You know, you can't. So I think, as Lori said, Doug said, there are a number of other pieces of this amendment that could be moved forward maybe on January 1 or soon thereafter. This portion of it can, you know, work through this process, come back to the council and be implemented with a framework, and that will keep the entire amendment from, you know, being delayed. I don't see any other way forward here. People may not like it. They may think that it's dragging your feet or whatever, but, you know, these are not simple legal questions, and they aren't going to be answered at this council meeting debating today when the parties involved that actually have to sign on the dotted line aren't here.
Jim.
Yeah, I support this motion, and that was the only reason I couldn't support the first motion was I knew we were putting something on there that couldn't happen, and if it did happen, we'd have a tied-up fleet. So I do support the intent of this motion.
Got Glenn.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. This is specifically the no-action alternative as a stopgap, right? And then we've already got closed Area 1 rules. That won't change. I mean, you've got 100% observer coverage in there. That remains?
That's correct.
Tom?
Thinking more about this, as I read this, this is truly a backstop only if this portion of the document, this portion of the plan, isn't developed in time. This isn't mandating 1 year. This is just saying up to 1 year. So with that in mind, you know, I'm prepared to support this. I actually perhaps have a stronger view of the capacity of the agency than even some of them themselves. I think they can get this done. So if it's understood and the intent is, if this thing's ready to roll, we put it on the water as soon as it's ready to roll, then I don't see any reason that we can't do this.
I have Frank Blount, then Dan, then I think we're going to call a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think everybody here is probably a little optimistic, and Dan may speak to this, but the MID just handed in their amendment, well, they haven't handed it over to the service yet. We haven't taken final action yet. Hopefully we'll do it today. Lori's going to take time to get it to the service. I think it's very optimistic. I doubt we're going to see January 1 for the whole of that. So no matter what we put in here, we're going to have something in place January 1. And this amendment, for if you go back on past history, we're probably looking at March sometime before it even gets put in place.
Dan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Frank. That's what I was going to say. Yes, Lori's doing a great job, but I think we're looking at a month or so before after this meeting before we receive the document. Typically, assuming things go smoothly, we would have about 6 to 7 months on the good side to implement that. So that puts us into the spring of next year for the core of this. These more challenging issues that are going to take some implementation development and perhaps a subsequent action, I think Mid-Atlantic took a wise approach, which was to target specifications next year that would implement in January of 2014 those subsequent measures. That's how we see that going. Thank you.
I'm going to call the question. All those in favor of the motion so indicate. 14 in favor. Opposed. 1. Abstention. 1. Recusal. 1. 14-1-1-1. Motion carries. Doug.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have another committee motion, and that is to move that a waiver for an at-sea observer be granted for a fishing trip if NEFOP cannot provide an observer within 24 hours of the vessel's notification of a prospective trip. A waiver will not be granted if the trip is to be include tows in areas at times associated with measures to avoid or protect river herring. The motion carried 9-0-1 at the committee.
Committee motion, no second. Discussion, Mark?
Just a point of order, Chairman. On that last motion that we passed, I think there was some confusion in terminology there. You mentioned option one. If you look in the decision document, option one is actually status quo on funding, not status quo on observer levels. Status quo on observer levels is alternative one. So that's what you intended, right? So we're going to have a, starting the fishing year, we're going to have 100% observer coverage, fully federally funded.
But what it's, as Lori pointed out, it is assumed that federal funds will be utilized to fully support the administration of the Fisheries Management Plan and data collection required through the provision in this amendment. While observer coverage may be desired or targeted at a higher rate, realized annual coverage would be based on the allocation of federal resources and would be subject to prioritization in the face of funding limitations. So that's the key part that's saying that during this point, during this interim period, it will be based, the amount of coverage will be based on what federal sources are available, regardless of what the target was.
Lori, did you have a comment?
I have a comment on the committee motion that's on the board now. I just wanted to point you to page 22 of the public hearing document. This motion for waivers does relate to, in some ways, to funding option one, which you just approved. The description for the provisions for waivers is just on page 22 of the public hearing document, and it says, in the event that federal funds are not sufficient to provide 100% coverage, provisions would be included to allow for waivers. Excuse me. The intent here is that I think one thing in this motion, you probably want to change NEFOP to NIMPS, because the idea here is that it would be just if an observer cannot be provided. It may not necessarily be a NEFOP observer. It might be a service provider observer or something like that. But if an observer cannot be provided, NIMPS would notify the vessel and issue the waiver. And then, as it noted in the document, there may be certain instances where the council does not want waivers issued, meaning that if an observer cannot be provided, the vessel cannot go on the fishing trip. This motion includes areas and times to protect river herring as one of those instances where waivers cannot be provided. Just something to keep in mind as we go through this process. Right now, this is the motion that the committee passed, but then the committee actually didn't recommend any specific areas and times to protect river herring. So the part of this motion with the exemption doesn't really apply to what the committee ultimately passed. So this may be an issue that we have to come back at the end and revisit based on whatever measures you pass for the river herring areas as well as access to the groundfish closed areas. That's another potential consideration is whether or not, depending on what you decide with the groundfish closed areas, whether or not you want to authorize trips without an observer under the waivers. So a couple of things here you may have to come back and clarify, but the idea here is that these would be waivers that would be authorized, granted by NIMFS, in the event that an observer cannot be provided either by the Science Center or by a third party, depending on the situation.
So your suggestion is that you put in be granted by NIMFS for a fishing trip if NEFOP cannot?
I would just say if NIMS cannot provide an observer, or if an observer, I would say actually be granted for a fishing trip if an observer cannot be provided within 24 hours. That way it doesn't specifically indicate who will be providing the observer. It just says that the waiver would be granted for a fishing trip if an observer cannot be provided within 24 hours.
Bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of concerns. One is, if this plays out as I think it will, and that the industry is contracting directly with observer providers to provide some portion of the sea days, which is what Laurie is alluding to, then those contracts will state the terms under which observers need to be provided, and we will not have any ability to regulate that relationship. So in terms of the agency's ability to determine if the contractor has provided the industry with an observer or can or cannot, I'm not quite sure how. We're going to need some time to figure that out because it's uncharted territory. And then the other one is the 24-hour pre-trip notification. It's my understanding that even if these were agency purchased observers, this was clearly our responsibility, that we would need a 48-hour pre-trip notification. What 24 does is it requires us to contract to change the terms of our contract with the providers so that they can be more responsive. And of course what that does is it increases costs and reduces the number of sea days. So all of these things are sort of part of the cost equation.
Lori.
The pre-trip notification is dealt with separately, it is a 48-hour pre-trip notification. So we'll be addressing that in a subsequent motion. With 100% coverage for A and B, how important is the pre-trip notification? I don't know. I mean, they have to have an observer on every trip. This language on page 22 was, I pulled this directly from the scallop fishery regulations for how NIMS handles issuing waivers for the scallop fishery and dealing with service providers. It mirrors the scallop fishery regulations in terms of actually the procedure for and the timing for notifying of observers. And it does say in the regulations that NIMS would notify the vessel within 24 hours if an observer cannot be provided, and that's whether it's through a service provider or not.
Okay, for the language modification, it was a committee motion. We can either go through the amendment process or I can ask that people accept us without objection. Seeing none. Okay, further discussion. Glenn.
I'd like to offer an amendment on that, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we have nobody objecting to the language, or did you want to do another amendment as well?
Just a small one.
Okay.
Where it says include tows in areas and at times put include tows in groundfish closed areas and at times.
Is there a second to that motion to amend? See? Sally? Okay. Dan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is one of those implementation details that I was speaking to earlier that on the surface it sounds simple, but in practice there are some confounding questions that have to be worked out so that when this is occurring in the, you know, on the weekend or the middle of the night or whenever it's occurring, there are protocols for how the observer companies, the vessel, and the agency respond. Those could also be regulations. As Dr. Karp was noting, that if some of this observer coverage is provided through an agreement with a third party from the central fund, that is not a contractual relationship that we would necessarily be privy to and how it's working out. So we have to have some backstop, whether it's a prohibition on sailing without that third party provided observer until you also apply to the NEFOP, for example, for an observer to cover that trip, and then you get the waiver. I want to stress that these are implementation details that we need some time to really hammer through. And the precise language of this motion could put us in a box where we'd have to come back to the council for broadening or clarification to supplement those and get those details through. Once we've had that workshop and once we've pounded this out and maybe talk to you a year from now about those details. Thank you.
Tom Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand the intent of the motion, but I think we need to keep this as simple as possible. We passed a motion strongly supporting 100%. I'd rather not start describing areas of the ocean where 100% means 100% and other areas where 100% means something less than 100%. In my view, we dealt with what in my mind is the lion's share of reasons to include waivers, and that's implementation concerns. We passed a motion that allowed for to take a different path and to allow this process time for details to be ironed out. But I worry that what we've been talking about here has been 100% coverage. And to me, there's no number of waivers that you can grant while maintaining 100%. And identifying certain areas of the ocean where that means something different, I think, is problematic for everybody involved. I think the service, and as Amy Van Atten said at the Herring Committee meeting, in sort of a counterintuitive way, including any waivers actually increase the per-day cost of putting observers in these boats, that less than 100%, anything less than 100%, any exemptions, increases the cost because it increases the likelihood that people are going to try to avoid taking observers. And we've seen that in a number of different cases. So I think from the perspective of just keeping it simple, we've dealt with implementation concerns. These boats won't be tied up to the dock at the start of this program because we don't have the system in place to put observers on there and to fund them. We're looking at designing a program that isn't completely novel. There are other high-volume fisheries on the West Coast. Even our existing Closed Area 1 program doesn't have waivers. You need an observer to leave the dock. And once we get this program up and running, I think our earlier motion of 100% indicates that we want an observer on every boat. So I don't support defining areas of the ocean where 100% means means anything less than an observer on every boat.
David Pierce.
Well, I'm a bit torn on this one, only because at the committee meeting we discussed the concept of having a waiver. I wasn't supportive of it. I didn't think it was a good idea, and I was relying primarily on my knowledge of what's happening with the groundfish fishery. And the groundfish is not the same as sea herring. Anyways, I supported the concept at the herring committee meeting only because we went a bit beyond the initial language within the document to make it clear that once we start focusing on river herring strategies to avoid or protect river herring, then there would be no waivers in those areas or at those times. So that's why I say I would support the motion as is. Well, I would support the motion on the board with a little bit of refinement because the maker of the motion changed it so it's not the way it should be. It should read, to include tows in the groundfish close areas and, okay, I'm sorry, I guess it was changed again, in areas and at times. So, I think it was anyway.
Yeah, okay, now it's the way it should be in my mind, because it makes it clear that we're talking about areas and times for river herring as well. So, again, I'll support the motion with this change, although I am still a bit leery of the whole concept of waivers themselves.
Okay. I'm going to go for and against in support of the motion. Mary Beth.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure if I'm in support of the motion or not. I was in support of the original motion that was made by the committee. This current motion that's on the table is a motion to amend, and I had really a question about that. I think some people's thinking is this is kind of status quo, but it's not status quo at all. I mean, currently, we need to have an observer on board a midwater trawl vessel to have access to closed area one. This amendment would require any vessel of category A or B to have an observer on board for access to any groundfish closed area. Those areas which we talked about yesterday, we're trying to do away with as quickly as possible.
And that's related to river herring.
And river herring as well. So that's a significant change. So if you are a purse seine vessel in the Gulf of Maine, that means you're not going to Jeffries unless you have an observer on board. And then our discussion yesterday about the change to SBRM, our expectation is the allocation, which will become non-discretionary, on these boats will go down significantly. So that's a very different outcome. And I would just ask Lori if the document contemplates that outcome in any way.
Well, the document certainly contemplates 100% observer coverage in the groundfish closed areas as part of the alternatives to allocate observer coverage, but also as part of the measures to maximize sampling and the measures to address access to the groundfish closed areas. So in that respect, it has been discussed. I mean, looking at the year-round groundfish closed areas, the document contemplates completely closing those areas to herring fishing. So that would also include the Western Gulf of Maine closure and the inshore Gulf of Maine. So to that extent, it's in the document and discussed in that context.
So thank you for that information. And just to clarify for people at the table what this really means. I mean, this is not a status quo. This is a whole new group of vessels and a whole new, you know, list of areas and where you can go, where you can't go. And we also, from the discussions from yesterday and today, we're not going to have even the current levels of observer coverage under the federal funding. So I support the, you know, the underlying motion and not the motion to amend.
Gene.
It's the question of clarification. I think I understand what is intended by the amendment. By adding in groundfish closed areas, that's independent of whether there's river herring measures, protective measures, right? So it probably is better to say in groundfish closed areas or in areas and times associated. Otherwise, it looks like it's the groundfish closed areas must, that the waiver doesn't apply only if there's river herring protection measures in a groundfish closed area. So, yeah, that, I think that clarifies that point.
Is that okay with the maker and the seconder? Okay. Someone in support of the motion to amend? Brian.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. We had a discussion at the, as Laurie was saying, at the herring committee meeting about extending the closed area one rule. So, you know, that's coming up. Seemed like a good idea to get this in here now on this at the same time. Because if we vote that in, I suppose that makes this a moot point. But the intention was to, if not exclude, at least gather more data about what's going on in specifically the Gulf of Maine closed areas.
Against. Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, there has to be some kind of a waiver process here. It doesn't matter what area you're in. You can't tie people to the pier because of something that happens that's entirely beyond their control. And I'll give you two examples. One is boats notified them. They're going 24 hours in advance. They get a call saying an observer from company XYZ is going to be there tomorrow. And all of a sudden, all the observers from company XYZ get the norovirus. And then they're all puking their guts out. None of them can go to work. So what's the guy supposed to do? Stay home? That's not right. Second example. Guy's on his way. He's driving up to Rockland, Maine from, I don't know, let's say Boston. Somewhere on 95 around Portland, his wheel bearing falls off. His tire falls off, rolls off. He goes into a ditch and crashes. Don't laugh. These things happen to me all the time with observers. Not me personally. The observers I get. So again, what, you know, what's the boat supposed to do? Is he supposed to stay home because of something that has nothing to do with him? There has to be a waiver process. You have to be able to contact somebody and say, hey, the observer hasn't showed up. Give me a waiver. Because you cannot keep people from making a living because of something that happens. It's entirely out of their control. So I cannot support the motion to amend, and I can support the original motion with some clarification language that, you know, explains very clearly how you contact somebody to get this waiver issued so you can leave the pier. Thank you.
And I thought you said you were going to say he got hit by a herring transport truck.
No, that would only be Dr. Pierce.
Yeah. Okay. In support of the motion, you've already had your bite at the apple. Okay. One more against. Terry Stockwell, I had you on the list. And Jim, you're after.
I appreciate your motion to amend, Glenn, but I mean, following up Dave's comments, I mean, it dilutes the concept of a waiver, and I believe that we're going to address the groundfish closure areas in a subsequent motion.
Jim, last bite.
Yeah, I just want to point out that this is unworkable for the industry. Sometimes they're down to one day a week, right? The observer doesn't show up for that day. He can't even go for another week. Not that he can go the next day or he can go in 5 hours. He can't even go for another whole week. No, I can't support this motion at all.
Okay, I'm going to call the question. All those in favor of the motion to amend? One. Opposed? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten, 11, 12, 13. 14. Abstention, 1. Recusal, 1. 1-14-1-1. The motion fails. We're on the main motion. Further discussion. Tom.
Just quickly point out again that having waivers at all is going to increase the complexity and increase the cost. I don't support having waivers beyond that interim period where we get this program up and off the ground. We don't have waivers in our existing Closed Area 1 program, and the fishery's been prosecuted. So I'm against waivers after we get this thing up and on the water. I think 100% should mean 100%.
Sally, then I'm going to call the question.
Thank you. Agreed. We had a waiver discussion under our last motion, the waivers for a year, and that's the time during which the program can be put in place.
Call the question. All those in favor of the motion as amended, so indicate.
As amended?
No. Oh, excuse me. It wasn't amended. The main motion. I'm sorry. One. Eleven in favor. Opposed. Four opposed. Abstention, 1. Recusal, 1. So the motion carries. Doug.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next motion, committee motion, you'll find on page 6 of the decision document under section 3.2.2. The committee recommends as a preferred alternative section 3.2.2 option 2, sub-options A through F on page 30 of the public hearing document. The motion carried 901.
Committee motion, no second required. Discussion. Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was the maker of this motion at the committee, and in general, these are good concepts, and we currently already are doing this on the boats. The Observer Program proposed these to sort of solidify that process, and I support the motion.
Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support the lion's share of these options, and understanding the committee's support that we go forward, I think I agree with Mary Beth that in general these are positive options. The one alternative here that I think is problematic is something that's been discussed in the past, is sub-option 2F, and that is the visual access of the caught end. During the rulemaking in, I think it was 2010, there was a back and forth about visual access and what ability there would be for someone from the rail to quantify fin fish in a bag that didn't come on board. And the answer was you couldn't quantify that if it doesn't come on board, it's impossible to quantify what's in that caught end. So with that in mind and our continued need to improve the sampling on this fleet and to make sure that we know all the catch and bycatch and can quantify that, I would like to bring a motion to amend this and simply remove alternative 2F. So the amended motion would be the committee motion, sub-options 2A through 2E.
Is there a second to that motion? Are you seconding his motion? Sally, are you seconding the motion? Okay. Sally McGee. Discussion? Dave Cathel.
Yeah, I'm opposed to this. We had this discussion at the Enforcement Committee. There's certain times when you simply can't put the fish aboard. If you're a bottom trawler and you've got a bag of dogfish and there's a few herring in there, you can't do it. You can't split the fish. They're not going in the boat. You can wind them up to the back of the boat. You can have the observer go back there with a camera and take a picture and verify that this is an enormous sausage of dogfish that you can't get in the boat, but you can't split them. They're not going in the boat. The only other alternative here is to drag them home, put the net on the clam flats, wait for the tide to go out, have somebody go pull the pucker out. This is just absurd. I just don't understand. This is a reasonable alternative. You bring it up as far as you can. The observer takes a picture of it, goes back and does some kind of, they got a way of, measuring to get an estimate of the volume and the size. And that's it. That's as good as you're going to get. The only way to get rid of dogfish at sea in a bottom trawler is to pull a tripper, cut the splitting strap, and drive around till the whole mess goes away. I've done that for as long as 7 hours. And when the whole mess went away, it took most of the top of the net with it. But that's it. That's the only way to deal with this. So, again, there are practical applications here that people have to consider. And this was put in here for a reason. So, I hope people will not support its removal.
In support of the motion to amend. Anyone against the motion to amend? Rodney and Doug.
Yeah, I'm against it all for the same reasons David said. When you're on a trawler and you get a big bag, you cannot safely lift it aboard a vessel. It cannot be done. So for those reasons, I'm against it. It becomes a safety issue.
Doug?
So I have a question for the maker of the motion. If we remove this, what have you gained? It doesn't say that Dave would, if you remove this, that Dave would have to bring his net up on board, does it? It just says vessel operators would be required to provide and assist NIMS approved observers in obtaining visual access to the caught end and any of its contents after pumping, and then on trawl vessels, the caught end and any remaining contact should be brought on board after pumping. If this is not possible, vessel operator required to work with the observer to ensure the observer sees the caught end. So now you're saying that you're not going to require the captains to work with the observer to be able to see the caught end. At least that's the way I don't see why you'd want to take that out.
In support of the motion, Tom?
Just in response to that, I agree that it's of no positive impact in my estimation quantitatively. We have the exemptions that allow for limited amounts of dumping in the case of dogfish, mechanical failure, and safety concerns. That wouldn't go away. Effectively, I don't see any value to this, except that I just don't see any value to this alternative. We have exceptions, we have maximized sampling provisions, and I think we need to move forward with those exceptions that we have. I just don't see any positive contribution from a picture or someone hanging over the rail looking at a bag. It's simply of no informational value from my estimate, and that's why I was looking to come out. None of the provisions for, or the allowances or exemptions from the maximized sampling would change in this. You're absolutely right. Mechanical failures or mechanical issues, safety concerns, and dogfish are all exempted. You allow, and if we take the committee's approach, you'll be allowed to dump those bags up to the cap, and I think that's entirely appropriate. I just don't see any informational value to having this, and that's why I brought the motion.
Laurie.
Thank you. I think that it's important to differentiate between slippage and operational discards, and I think that there's a little bit of confusion here because I'm hearing about all these exemptions for slippage and stuff as we're talking about these measures. These measures are not the measures to address net slippage. These are the measures to maximize sampling by the observers at sea. This has nothing to do with slip bags and when fish are released in a bag. This has to do with providing the observer with the maximum ability to document operational discards. Slippage is defined in the amendment clearly to not include operational discards, and slippage is dealt with in a series of options to deal with slippage. This measure was brought forward and developed through the committee and the PDT with the support of the observer program as a way to help the observers to better maximize their ability to document the small amounts of fish that remain in the bag at the end of a pumping operation. The observers have a detailed discard log where they document and sample these fish, and in any case where the observer cannot identify the fish, they estimate the catch and list it as fish NK or herring NK. And the observers have gone through a series of steps to improve their sampling practices and their protocols to better document the fish at the end of a pumping operation. And if you look at the data in the document, you'll see that fewer and fewer fish are ending up in that fish NK and that herring NK category. This measure is an effort to further reduce the fish that end up in the fish NK and the herring NK category by enhancing the observer's ability to get at the little fish, the little bits of fish that remain in the net at the end of a pumping operation without requiring every vessel to bring the bag on board because logistically it may not be possible for some vessels. So I just want to emphasize here, we're talking about operational discards. We're talking about better sampling of fish that are documented by the observers at the end of a pumping operation. We are not talking about fish that are released without being sampled. If the fish are being released without being sampled, they fall under slippage. And that has a whole other set of measures in this amendment to address it. So I think we need to, it's important to keep the difference between operational discards and slip catch clear in your own minds when you're making the decisions about these provisions.
I'm going to make a decision that we have bigger fish to fry here today. And I'm going to call a question on this. All those in support of the motion to amend? One. Opposed? One, two, three, four, five, six, 13, one abstention, one recusal. The motion fails. So we're back on the main motion. Further discussion. Call the question. All those in favor? Fifteen. Oppose. Abstention. Recusal. 15-0-1-1. Motion carries. Doug.
On page 7 of the decision document, the committee recommends as a preferred alternative for section 3.2.4, option 1, the no action alternative. Motion carried, 9-1-1.
Committee motion, no second required, discussion. Mayor Beth.
I just have a question about this. I agree with the committee motion and support it. And when we think about the process in which we might be working out details of observer coverage and, the value of electronic monitoring, the value of shoreside monitoring, I mean, depending on what we decide our goals and objectives for this program might be in the future, something like this frameworkable, or do we need to have a specific, you know, something specific in this amendment to say this could be frameworkable in the future? I think it's extremely problematic to have to retain dogfish, for example. But, you know, we may find out that really what the, you know, is truly needed is, you know, electronic monitoring. You keep everything but dogfish. And we'd want to have an option like this available. So I guess my question is, I agree with the committee motion, and do we need to add something like this to the list of frameworkable items? Do we need to be that specific, or do we have flexibility as we move forward?
Lori.
Well, I guess I would ask for some clarification from Jean on this issue, but my understanding is that we could not add implementing a maximized retention experimental fishery implementing maximized retention in the fishery as a frameworkable measure if we don't have at least the groundwork laid in this amendment or in the plan that addresses some provisions for maximized retention and evaluates it. I don't think you can just add a new measure to the list of frameworkable items, but I would defer to Jean.
Yeah, I concur with that. It's you have to, the framework adjustments are meant to adjust a current measure in a way that's sort of contemplated when you first put it into place. It's not to, you can't just come up with a slew of different potential items in the future that really haven't been analyzed in the document that's implementing that frameworkable measure and then framework them. So I think Lori correctly analyzed that.
Mary Beth?
Are we going to have some discussion at some point about full retention of allocated species in groundfish? And is that, so I guess I'm trying to interpret Jean's comments in general, that would require us to do an amendment in groundfish to have full retention? I mean, is there something different here that I'm missing?
Yeah, I guess maybe we can wait till that issue comes up. So I'd have to think through that. Yeah.
Further discussion? Seeing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor of the motion so indicate. 15. Opposed. Abstention. Recusal. 15-0-1-1. Motion carries. Doug.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Before we take the next motion, Lori's asked us to provide a little bit of background on the slippage part of the discussion document.
Okay, thank you. I'm just going to run through the table on page 8 of the decision document. It's the last pink one. Just to give you a little bit of an overview of some of the issues that have been discussed relative to the measures to address. There are several options under consideration, 1 through 4, with 4A, B, C, D being slight modifications to each other. Just so that you're aware, option 2 requires the release catch affidavit. Option 2 could be implemented in conjunction with option 3 or option 4. The hearing committee, the decisions that need to be made, obviously, are which options do you want to consider? Which permit holders do you want these measures to apply to? You've chosen 100% coverage for A and B permit holders, but the measures to address net slippage, as well as any of the other components of this amendment, could still apply to A, B, and C. That's something that needs to be decided. Right now in the document, the measures to address net slippage are proposed to apply to A, B, and C permit holders. The committee recommends 4C with a 10-trip termination threshold by management area and gear type. So it would be a little bit of a modification to 4C. The 10 events would be by gear type, single and paired midwater trawl together as one gear type, and then per seine, and then bottom trawl. So for each management area, there would be a threshold of 10 slippage events in that management area for each of those three gear types. The Enforcement Committee made some recommendations about the wording, and I guess I just would clarify to you that whatever measures are ultimately adopted, this is something the PDT noted as well. We need to just make sure when we write the final language that the wording applies to all the different gear types that have these permits. This isn't going to be just a midwater trawl measure. Bottom trawl vessels slip fish too, and there are bottom trawl A and B vessels in the fishery. So we need to word the final language of these measures to accommodate vessels that don't pump fish and to accommodate purse seine vessels, which all of that we can do if everybody agrees with that. We'll just do that in the final language. The other thing that I want to clarify here, as I mentioned, slippage is defined in Amendment 5, and these measures would apply to just those events. Slippage is defined in the public hearing document on page 31. Keep in mind, these options are called the Closed Area 1 provisions. That's, at this point, a misnomer. They were developed initially based on the Closed Area 1 provisions, but through the development of these measures, we've changed little bits here and there to make them more appropriate for this amendment and to apply across the entire fishery. So where it says Closed Area 1 provisions, don't interpret that literally. It's not exactly the Closed Area 1 provisions. It is what it says in the document. So read the measure in the document. That's what the measure actually does. It's just a little bit different than what might be going on in Closed Area 1. The other thing is the Mid-Atlantic Council did pass a motion for the mackerel amendment that you should be aware of. Right now, the committee is recommending 4C, which includes the 10 threshold trip termination. Under 4C, there are three exceptions listed, safety, mechanical failure, and dogfish are the three exceptions. So those would be the three exceptions where a vessel would be allowed to slip fish. Under 4C, which is the Herring Committee's recommendation, only the dogfish exception would not count towards the trip termination threshold. So safety and gear would count along with any other slippage events. Dogfish would not count. On the Mid-Atlantic Council's motion, the Mid-Atlantic Council passed a motion for the 10 slippage events to apply to the entire mackerel fishery with none of those three exceptions counting. So safety, mechanical failure, and dogfish, none of those would count towards the trip termination threshold under the Mid-Atlantic Council's option. So I'm not really sure how to resolve some of the inconsistencies because these are going to be the same vessels in some cases, mackerel vessels and herring vessels. So we have a proposal from the committee that allows for one exception. The Mid-Atlantic has their proposal for three exceptions. We have trip termination thresholds by gear type and management area. The Mid-Atlantic Council's amendment just has fishery-wide termination thresholds. So in the Mid-Atlantic Council's mackerel fishery, when 10 mackerel slippage events are hit, the mackerel fishery closes, like the whole fishery. The fishery doesn't close. Trip termination then applies for across the entire fishery. In the herring fishery, it's by management area. I'm not sure how all of the inconsistencies are going to be resolved, but I just wanted to note that we do have some inconsistencies with what the mackerel amendment or what the MID just approved in the mackerel amendment. And I think that's about it.
Doug.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Herring Committee passed a motion to recommend option 4, sub-option C, closed area 1 provision trip termination after 10 slippage events by each gear type, midwater trawl, and that includes both single and paired, purse seine, and bottom trawl, with an added exception for a slippage event. A slippage under number 3, spiny dogfish clogging the pump for all gear types. Language will be modified to reflect the requirements for all gear types and for vessels that do not pump fish. And that last part gets to the Law Enforcement Committee recommendation.
Committee motion, no second required. Discussion. I have Mary Beth, Tom, Frank, and Dave.
So in general, I think that these alternatives were designed to discourage dumping fish. And in general, any kind of alternatives that we could put in place that actually function that way, I am supportive of. To Lori's concerns about the inconsistencies, the mackerel fishery takes place in one area at a certain time of the year. The herring fishery, as we all know, has different areas, different gear types, and that's why the committee added that to the motion. And I don't see that as problematic as an inconsistency. I think we're fine there. I don't see a problem. The only problem I have with the motion is relative to some of the comments that were made by the agency relative to National Standard 10 and safety. I think it is problematic for us to move something that has punitive impacts to the industry and at the same time and say, oh, by the way, you know, this is going to count even if you're concerned about safety. That's kind of an issue. In general, I did vote for this motion at the committee, and I think that overall the motion is fine, except for the one caveat on safety. I think that I would like for all of you to consider that part.
Tom Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little bit confused and concerned about the misnomer or perceived misnomer regarding closed area 1 rules. All through this process, my understanding, and I think many people's understanding, is that what was on the water for closed area 1, which worked to reduce dumping and increase sampling of catch, was what we were anticipating extending across the range of the fishery. I think that program, and Mary Beth brings up safety concerns. I think there were safety concerns expressed during the development of those rules, but they've already been through the Federal Register process, the rulemaking process. They're on the water, and we haven't seen, we really haven't, seen those issues crop up in the function of that program. I think it's performing exactly as it was developed to. I think we should take into consideration the law of unintended consequences and recognize that if we have an existing program that's on the water, that's been on the water for a couple years and works in one area, that the simplest thing to do is simply extend that
not try to create a different program with other tweaks that we haven't really found any justification for. Dogfish can be dumped. They just kind of against that cap that we set. And if people feel like that cap's inappropriate, then maybe we should have a discussion about where that cap should be set. But I think everything should be counted, and I think we have a program on the water right now that works and should be extended. And my understanding of this option and this motion is that it's existing closed area one provisions, and we're extending what we have and what's working.
Frank?
Yeah, thank you. And I don't remember this coming up in committee or in discussion, but maybe somebody can refresh my memory. Because I know you can't pump it, but what happens if there's a marine mammal in the net? I'm hoping that we would want somebody to slip it as fast as possible, that it might be alive. Is that going to count against the cap? Is it going to be something that we're going to be allowed to say, you know, slip the net and hopefully whatever's in there can go? Because you can't pump it. You can't bring it on board. We don't want somebody to leave a marine mammal in there for as long as possible, so... Was that ever discussed, Doug? I don't remember it.
That would count as slippage.
So that would be a... Dave Pierce? Laurie, did you have some comment on that?
Well, I did want to clarify this issue with the closed area one provisions. These measures were developed based on the Closed Area 1 provisions, and they fully capture the intent of the Closed Area 1 provisions. I just want to be clear that the measures are as they're worded in the document. You're approving what's written under the option. You're not approving the regulations for Closed Area 1. We had to take the Closed Area 1 provisions, which apply to a very small area and a very small component of this fishery with only one gear type fishing there, and figure out how to apply those provisions and the intent across the entire fishery with different vessels, different size vessels, different gear types. So the rules just don't translate word for word. You know, there are no purse seiners in closed area one. So, you know, there are no bottom trawl vessels that don't pump fish in closed area one. So, yes, these rules are intended to reflect the spirit of the closed area one provisions, but they can't just be translated across the entire fishery. Those are where some of the minor changes occurred, which is why I'm saying now it's a misnomer to call them closed area one regulations. They capture the entire intent, but they had to be adjusted to apply to the entire fishery. They also, closed area one provisions, address operational discards differently. We define slippage in this amendment and develop these measures to address slippage and addressing operational discards through other measures. So again, there are some differences while maintaining the intent. Also, if you recall in closed area one, if a slippage event occurs, the vessel has to leave the area. Well, we now have a trip termination provision in here, but, you know, if a vessel is fishing in management area two, you can't tell the vessel to leave management area two, especially if the vessel can't fish offshore. So again, you know, there are reasons why some of the provisions had to be adjusted to apply across the fishery. So just, you know, as you're approving this, you're approving the wording that's in the document. You're not approving the regulations in closed area one. One other thing on the committee motion, something triggered my memory, and I went back to the committee meeting summary, and I do remember now in this motion, at one point, and I'm hoping some of the other committee members can help me here, the motion that the committee considered at one point included option two and option four. Option two is the release catch affidavit, and then option four were these measures. And I'm just looking at the summary in the committee meeting summary. We perfected this motion like six times. And somehow through the perfections, option two dropped out. So I'm not sure what the intent was with respect to option two, but I would just note that if the committee's intent was to actually have that in there. It's not in the final motion that passed, but it's in the summary in some of the previous perfections. And I can't recall where it might have fallen out.
Doug.
Now, Lori, my recollection was that we didn't feel it was necessary because part of what's written in here under bullet four is if the net is released for any of the reasons stated above, the vessel operator would be required to complete assigned sign a release catch affidavit, and that's the reason we eliminated alternative two from, or option two, excuse me, from the motion.
Lori, does that resolve it?
Yeah, I couldn't remember. Thank you.
Okay, I have Dave Pierce.
Someone has already made note of the fact that Mid-Atlantic Council does have a different perspective, a different approach to use regarding the way in which the safety issue and the mechanical failure issue would be addressed relative to the counting of those events against 10 slippage events. I was at the Mackerel Committee, and I did in New York, and I did argue in favor of the New England Council approach, and I explained why our approach made more sense than the way in which the Mid-Atlantic Council was going to proceed. For example, I reflected on the fact that we have had many meetings, many committee meetings, and much public testimony regarding the possibility of the cap never being reached if indeed a captain decides to say, because he realizes if the 10 is reached, he may have to go back to port, or he will have to go back to port, the captain can say, I have got a safety concern. So what is the observer to do? It's a safety concern, therefore it doesn't count, or there's a mechanical problem. Well, does the observer know whether there's really a mechanical problem? It doesn't count. So possibly, and most likely, the 10 slippage events will never occur, because why in the world would a captain want to go back to port because now he's responsible for the 10th slippage event and, of course, the termination of trips subsequent to that. So I still feel that what we have on the board, this particular motion, makes far more sense than what the Mid-Atlantic Council has done, because I think they have created an ineffective cap on, well, slippage cap relative to trip termination. Whether or not what happens now through the Mackerel plan and the Mid-Atlantic Council's actions somehow compromises what we may want to do if this passes, I'm not sure. I don't think it affects us. I've given this further thought. I don't think it affects us. But this, to me, is a wise way to proceed. It's not the way I had initially wanted to proceed, in that at the Herring Committee I did favor another option relative to our actually assigning a penalty of a tonnage of herring for every slipped event. But I'm not going to push that now, because I know I don't have support for that particular strategy. However, what's on the board is the best alternative we have before us, and I think the alternative that will acquire the necessary council support for passage.
Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As far as safety goes, our vessels are designed to carry herring. We're tanked, and for example, one of our boats has 6 tanks. And the captain is very systematic in the way he puts fish aboard that boat, and it is based on the stability of that vessel. And that is a safety issue for our vessel and our crew. So, again, the safety issue to me is of concern. And the agency did provide comments on this particular section, and I was hoping that maybe they would weigh in and just reiterate those comments.
Terry Stockwell.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. From my perspective, the net slippage measures are one of the primary components of this entire action, and I support the committee's motion for a number of reasons. It allows for accountability. It provides incentives. It gives the industry flexibility by breaking into the different gear types. We have a very different fishery than the Mid. Mid's measures may be well applicable for them, but I agree with Dr. Pierce that these measures are more applicable for the Atlantic herring fishery. And my intent when I made the motion at the committee was to include Category C, and I wanted to have that on record.
Chairman Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the concerns that Dr. Pierce has pointed out with respect to the enforceability of these measures and the fact that the determination may be essentially self-reported. We discussed these concerns as a council, and with respect to the exemptions, some of the members simply were not comfortable counting events against a cap that might be safety related. So I think our discussion went to that point. We ended up with all three categories of exemptions. But I think to step back a little bit, we all recognize that this was a starting point. We agreed that these measures could be modified through future specification exercises. And obviously, if we come out of a year's fishery and look at the data and see 20 slippage events that were identified as a safety-related slippage event, clearly we have a problem that needs to be addressed. So, again, we viewed this as a starting point. On the one hand, I think we wanted to send a strong signal to the industry discouraging slippage events, and I think that's what our proposed measures will do. By the same token, we acknowledge the fact that it would be appropriate to have certain categories of exemptions, and those are reflected in our final recommendation. But again, I think it does send a strong message that slippage events are to be discouraged. But we recognize that this would be modified in future specification exercises as well.
Dave Cahill.
Well, I was doing all right till Terry's comment. Does this apply to C boats or not? Does the original vote to limit this to A and B boats trump anything else? Therefore, it's only A and B. This is relatively important to me. Well, the reason it's important is it says on observed trips. And if there's no mandatory observer coverage for Category C boats, then it's effectively moot.
Well, no, when you have an observer on board.
When you have an observer, that might be twice a year or something. The reason I'm concerned with this is, quite frankly, that a number of these measures are not doable by small boats, and I was never contemplated this. There's a powerful safety disincentive here if you're going to be required to go home if you don't put Dogfish aboard. And these small bottom trawl boats cannot put those fish on the boat, but they're going to try because they don't want to go home. They're out there to fish for a day. Like somebody said earlier, we're only allowed to go maybe one day a week. I'm very concerned. I probably won't vote for this unless it excludes the sea boats, but, I just want people to know why. And it's the issue of having to put fish over the stern and provide closed area one provisions. Closed area one is where large offshore vessels fish that can carry large amounts of fish. Putting the fish across the deck and out the other side is probably not as much of a safety concern. We have no way to do that. They can't go in one side and out the other. They're going out with two guys standing there pitching them over. That's how they're leaving. Anytime they're in the boat, the vessel is compromised safety-wise because there's too damn much weight in the boat. So, again, think about it, folks. Decide what you want to do. Obviously I have a vested interest as a sea boat, so I won't make a motion to change this. But consider what you're up to.
Lori.
There probably does need to be some clarification. Just to remind you, the council back during the development of this amendment a couple years ago passed a motion that all of the catch monitoring measures in Amendment 5 would apply to A, B, and C vessels. So everything's been written up in the document to reflect that. The decision has been made to do 100% observer coverage on just A and B. So I would just encourage you, as you go through these, to think about whether or not these measures should apply to C vessels. This particular measure, the intent was originally to apply these measures to C vessels on trips with an observer on board. Now, if you're talking about a measure that is tied to a trip termination threshold, you know, you need to think about whether or not there's an effectiveness issue if you don't have 100% observer coverage. I mean, is it, you know, if you're only going to have 30% observer coverage on the sea vessels, is it appropriate to include them in this measure and count their slippage events towards that trip termination? Those are the things that need to, there may be some consistency reasons why you wouldn't want to include sea vessels, but you need to just clarify, because right now everything in the document, I believe, is written to apply to all limited access herring vessels.
Doug.
Just for some clarification to try and address some of Dave's concerns, you know, I understood that it applied to sea vessels, but I also know within the motion we purposely added language will be modified to the requirement of all gear types for vessels that do not pump fish. And that got specifically at a law enforcement committee recommendation that under bullet 3 we add the words after not been pumped on board or brought, so we'd have fish that have not been pumped or brought on board may be released if the vessel operator finds that could compromise the safety, there was a mechanical failure, and spiny dogfish clogged the net. And as at least within this motion, the spiny dogfish clogging would not count towards the slipped events, and it was intended only to apply to observed trips, regardless of whatever your coverage was going to be. So I think we tried to cover those concerns at the committee level.
Further discussion? Dan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As Mary Beth asked, I will read from our letter of several weeks ago. The trip termination alternatives may create the situation of the vessel operator having to choose between the trip termination or bringing catch aboard the vessel despite a safety concern or mechanical failure. Such a provision must be consistent with National Standard 10. So most of you have seen our letter. Just as she asked specifically about that, I wanted to restate it. But I also wanted to restate our concerns about having sufficient rationale for the number 10. We need to, as part of our justification in making this federal regulations, fishing regulations, have to have some kind of rationale that connects this trigger of 10 trips and why the 11th has the penalty associated with it as opposed to the 4th or the 14th, and why that number in particular is appropriate for this trigger. I'll turn to Gene to see if he wants to, with the chairman's permission, amplify upon that. Thank you.
No, I think you correctly stated the concerns, and that we hope there'll be the additional rationale provided in the final document that comes to us if this is approved.
Paul.
I think, Jane, from a NEPA standpoint, it's 0, 5, or 10 that's being analyzed, so we have a range of reasonable alternatives, and the council wants to have a number. So I think you're adding some complication to our NEPA requirements to look at a reasonable range of alternatives, and it's 0. We've looked at 5 and 10.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, I mean, it's not a matter, this isn't a NEPA question. This is a question justifying why that's the range of alternatives and why not 10, 30, 50. I'm not suggesting those are make sense. But it's just to try to get some understanding as to why the range of around 10 is one that was picked. I mean, is there a basis for that?
Tom Dempsey, and then Doug Grout.
Thanks very much. And addressing Gene's concerns, I recognize the need to justify this. In my mind, the reason for choosing 10, in addition to what Paul laid out, is on page 433 of the document, we're looking at 2010 observed slippage events.
And, you know, by area, we have between 8 and 12. And these measures are intended to reduce, certainly not increase, slippage. So from where I sit, I think we're looking at recent information on observed slippage events. We're setting a cap in line with that, with the understanding that hopefully going forward we're going to reduce that number.
Doug Grout.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that was my exact point that I was going to make. I think it's in the document, our rationale right here on that particular table. So,
further discussion. I call the question. All those in favor of the motion so indicate. Fourteen in favor, opposed, one, abstention, one, recusal, one. 14, one, 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 the motion carries. Doug, that gets us through the first section. Just about on schedule for lunch break. So let's take a break and come back at, we're scheduled for 1:15. I just want, this isn't a threat to council members, I just want to make it clear, though, we are leaving here when this is done today. So we have some work to do.
And Mr. Chairman, if the other meetings that we had on this go like this one, we will be out of here by 5:00.